No.
If everybody would please take their seats. Well, okay, we're going to get started. We've got an ambitious schedule, and basically we've invited people in today to give us a review of how we as state policymakers can help Minnesota and the state be more competitive in a business climate versus other states, specifically when we're competing with other states and other countries, in fact, for jobs and trying to keep Minnesota growing jobs here. So we've got a number of people to testify, and we'd ask you to keep your testimony to about 10 to 15 minutes, and if we do that, if we keep the questioning to direct and on point as possible, we'll try to get through everybody and get everybody out in a timely manner. Our first testifier will be Mike Hickey from Mike Hickey and Associates, Hickey and Associates. And Mr. Hickey, if you'd come forward, you've got a PowerPoint. Mr. Hickey is a site selection consultant who helps businesses determine what is the best venue to locate their new business or expansion. So, Mr. Hickey, if you'd like to expand on the introduction, please feel free.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the committee. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about Minnesota and, from our perspective, the competitiveness of Minnesota. Since I live in Minnesota, our company is located in Minnesota, but we travel throughout the United States and throughout the world, helping companies figure out the best place to grow, expand, and develop their business. And what we always work with our clients is the right community for the right business at the right time and, if appropriate, with the right incentives, if incentives do or do not make sense. I believe that, Mr. Chairman, they have a handout also.
Yep. The handout's in the members' packets.
The first page just is a little bit about our background, who I am. Started the company 20 years ago. Have worked in the corporate world myself with General Electric Company, also with the Pillsbury Company. Have owned companies for 20 years, and also spent time on the public side in the state of Maryland managing employment and training and related economic development programs and activities. So it kind of gave me a sense of how things are perceived from the public side and also the private side. And I know you're going to have a lot of people that you're going to hear from today from the business community, and hopefully we echo with each other. And I think there's a lot of good folks who are going to speak, and I think they have a lot of good information from different perspectives, because you really need to look at the different perspective from business, I think, from large business, small business, and the type of business. The key points that I want to talk about are, what are the key drivers from our perspective working with companies look for when they look to relocate into a certain community, a certain state, and a certain area. Also, why has Minnesota been very successful? Minnesota has been very successful. Where do we go from here? And also, what can Minnesota do, I think, from my perspective, to continue to stay on the top and continue to try to attract businesses? There are facts, I think, that are evident today, and this is the reality of the market. Number one, it's a global market. Minnesota is competing on a global playing field. There's also very intense state-by-state competition for business, particularly the type of business that is prioritized in a certain state and that brings the best-paying jobs and also the best capital investment into a community. Also, I want to talk about Minnesota and the opportunities, I think, going forward, but also realistically what the future may bring for any state, any community, in terms of trying to attract business, and particularly staying on the cutting edge, particularly with the changing dynamics every day in business, every day creating new opportunities through technology and a lot of other means. Minnesota has done very well staying on top of that, but the challenge is how to continue to stay on top of that. Key drivers, from our perspective, there's a lot of decisions that go into deciding where a company, if they want to consolidate, if they want to grow, if they want to expand. And a lot of our clients are very large clients, so when they come to a community and want to work with the community, they're usually talking about fairly significant jobs and also capital investment. But there's key elements that transcend all companies, that are important to all companies. Below that, there's a lot of quantitative and qualitative factors that go into making the decision, and it depends on the type of company, medical manufacturing company versus bioscience versus high tech versus food manufacturing versus a service organization versus a service organization. But there are usually two or three elements that we always look at. One is the available labor force in a particular community, the ability to recruit, retain the right kind of skill level at the right kind of wages, so the idea is for a company to not just survive, but thrive in a community. Another key piece is the cost of doing business. Two top elements that we look at, first of all, and also on the qualitative side, there's the element of education, the element of the quality workforce, and also on the quantitative, it is quantitative, although some people may say it's somewhat subjective, is the perception of the business-friendly nature of the state of a particular community. And again, what that relates to is the opportunity to thrive within a community. No company wants to come to a community, grow in a community, and not be successful in a community. Thoughts on moving forward with Minnesota. What can Minnesota do? Minnesota has been very successful. I think a lot of the success that Minnesota's realized is through its labor force. A lot of the success has been through its current base of companies that is located in Minnesota. The national statistics show 75% of all new jobs, all capital investment, come from existing business in a state or a community. Very, very important to understand the businesses you have, nurture, develop, and build on the businesses you have, while at the same time trying to set in motion the opportunities in Minnesota so that other businesses and other communities would perceive Minnesota as a good place to do business and the right place to do business. Public incentives. I know I've talked to different legislators. We go around the country working with every state in the union, working with a lot of the communities in the union, and there's a lot of discussion around the role of public incentives in the whole job search and in the whole economic development process. I maintain, because I've seen it over and over and over again, that, well, number one, all states do it. All states compete. Minnesota is surrounded by states that are very, very aggressive in public incentives. Is that the only decision factor? No. But can it make a difference in a company wanting to reduce its risk, increase its opportunity, and perhaps even expand quicker than they thought? Then those are opportunities that present themselves, and we have to weigh that as part of the cost of doing business. I think Minnesota has some good opportunities that you've developed. I think some of the programs that I point out here are good programs. I've seen them work, seen them successful. The JobZ program, the TIP program, the infrastructure support, the job skill training program, all very important programs that add value not just to a business. It's win-win. The significant value more than any, I think, is to the community. The communities win big. It's a small investment that pays huge dividends. So that is one of the pieces of the puzzle. But remember, the key factors that we always have to look at regardless of the business. It's the cost of doing business, it's the available labor, and the perceived business friendliness of a state or a particular community. I think the bottom line is that for Minnesota, you can be successful. Minnesota's been extremely successful, and I've attached some studies and surveys that shows Minnesota's traditionally come out in the top 10 of opportunities, of bringing in business opportunities, growing opportunities, top 10 of all other states in the United States. But you can't rest on laurels. You have to continue to do that. And perception outside of Minnesota, it's sometimes hard to understand perception outside of where we are, but perception outside of Minnesota is very real. And really didn't get into it, but there is a perception that being a highly regulated state, now good or not good, there's a perception. There's a perception of Minnesota being a high tax state. Although Minnesota has done a very good job, and I promote it, and I think the Department of Employment and Economic Development has done a wonderful job promoting around the country that this is a good place, that costs are coming down, opportunities are going up, and that, by the way, it's a major hub right now for medical manufacturing, for bioscience, and those industries, which are very, very exciting industries. So the challenge is to continue the challenge. It's to recognize the challenge, continue the challenge, and understand, and I'm sure you'll hear from all the other folks here, that businesses are in businesses for a reason. And business provides a lot of private wealth. Business provides wealth to the state. Business provides tax revenue. But at the same time, business needs to understand that they have the opportunity to thrive within a community. So with that, people are free to contact me at any point, but with that, Tim, I'd be happy to take any questions or respond to any suggestions.
Questions from members? Representative Kavima.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hickey.
Yes, sir.
Better looking than the other Mike Hickey.
I don't know. I've never met Mike Hickey.
You're lucky.
Anyway.
Thank you, sir.
Your bottom line, your bullet is you got to reduce the cost of doing business, and then you got to have an excellence in education. I contend that Minnesota has those bioscience businesses and Medtronics and whatever because we had an excellent education. We had one of the best educational systems in the country, and when you always said you were from Minnesota, you could get a job anywhere. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think our schools have been hurt, but we've kept reducing business expenses. But it costs money it takes tax dollars to have a good educational system. So if we keep reducing your taxes as you want us to, who pays for education?
Well, I'm not really involved in the discussions with the legislature and involved in the education funding, but you're absolutely right, sir, that Minnesota is recognized as a high-quality, high-education state. Minnesota has to maintain that, but I think what a business will tell you, we have been forced the last 20 years, and I started with General Electric Company, so I understood what it meant when we had to really go back and look at our business and critique it very carefully in terms of where we were spending money, how we were doing it, and how we need to get the cost down. We have came up with best practices. I think best practices in education. We came up with money that was smart money to apply where it really, really mattered and where it really was going to have an effect on the positive welfare of business and residents in the state of Minnesota. But I really don't get into the political discussions around that. I just know what my businesses understand, what they need, and they rely on us to help them understand if that process and that system is good in a particular state.
Yeah.
Representative Rucker.
I didn't want you to get into politics. I didn't mean to pose it as a political question. I would pose it as a, you know, business question, because if you keep want us to keep trending down in taxes but have an excellent educational system, it's, you know, you have to raise the money from somewhere. I thought it's a good... The committee will tell you I'm the world's poorest capitalist. I have admitted that time and time again, but you are probably a very good one, so I just was hoping that you could give me the...
Well, I'm a believer in the market, sir. Yeah. That the positive market creates jobs and creates opportunity and revenue. I'm not sure.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things you mentioned was business climate, and I think, you know, even though I'm a Democrat, I think sometimes you have an image as anti-business, which I can't figure out, because basically we rely on them for jobs for everyone. But I've talked to some people who are pretty high up in some... I had a cousin who was in a top 100 national corporation to discuss things a lot, so I think not totally unrelated to business, but quite a few other people. And with regard to business climate, he was pointing out, and some others have pointed out to me, that partly this is created, the perception is created by the businesses in your state or your metro region. And he was pointing out the same things, and he originally is from here, that are criticized here by business organizations give a bad perception of here, and yet he was pointing out that the business organizations in other states were playing up those exact same facts as positives. And I thought that was interesting. In fact, I've even seen some things that played into that recently. Texas, for instance, is playing up some things that are being criticized here to the business community. So it seems like a lot of this perception is created by your own business entities here. And just, do you have any comments on that? Do you think they're wrong that people would say that, or just...
I'm not sure. I mean, first of all, I don't mean at all to be critical of Minnesota. So Minnesota's done a wonderful job in terms of retaining and growing business. And Minnesota's a lot to be proud of, and has continued to be in the top 10 by all studies I've seen over the last 10 years. The challenge is to make sure that Minnesota continues to be in the top 10, or why not be number one, in terms of business perception from clients within being spread to potential businesses outside. I think businesses are doing very well in Minnesota. The businesses that can find employees are doing very well in Minnesota. Businesses who are starting to reconsider certain things are the businesses that are having a difficulty finding adequate numbers and retaining adequate numbers of good, qualified people. And that's the spectrum, sir. That's from, you know, some of your basic jobs up to some of your most technical, sophisticated positions.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question. I know we have to move on. As an example of what I think you're talking about, and it concerns me, is the level of what's happening in our post-secondary education system. And one of the things about Texas is that there's a lot of question as to why they're moving so many major corporations there, and so I started looking into this around nationally, and they have put incredible amounts of money into their college level system, and so that they're turning out things, and I wondered if you had any knowledge of that, or how that, apparently that I saw the president of Stanford saying about the same kind of thing, that's and also I think it was Don Chambers, who isn't exactly a Democrat, I think he was the fourth largest fundraiser for Bush, but saying the same type of thing. So do you have I don't know if you have any experience with that in the type of clients you have or not.
Mr. Hickey.
I think as a country, we look at what's happening globally in terms of education, in terms of the type of programs that people are going into, being trained in, the science, the math, the other high technology fields where the new jobs are going to be. I think we need to step back and take a look as a state vis-a-vis that competition, vis-a-vis competition with other states, on what we're doing to promote and develop the type of education that's going to continue to take us to the next level and continue to make Minnesota a state that's most attractive. Education is essential, and I guess it's around the type of education, the practice around it. But if you look at the Southeast United States, and the Southeast United States has not been known as the most educated, affluent area in the United States. But they're attracting a lot of good companies. And there's reasons why they're attracting a lot of good companies, and they're getting migrations from other states into those states as well.
We've got Representative Gunther and then Representative Paul, then we need to move on. Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rocavina, it's always nice to listen to your points of view, and it's really funny. Minnesota is number one, two, or three in the nation of public education. That's not speculation, that's fact. And when we look at taxes, it's a comparison with other states, and that can come up with absolute facts, too. The thing that I look at is, what is the perception of potential industries moving into our state? Do they perceive this as getting fair value for the taxes they pay? And in that case, I think we might be right. Evidently, we are, because the metro area is growing very fast.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Specifically, Mr. Hickey, when you talk about what drives businesses to expand here and to consolidate here and to move to Minnesota, three questions, and I'll just shoot them out to you and you can answer. How important are energy costs, particularly electrical costs, and where does Minnesota stand in comparison to other states when it comes to cost of electricity? And how important is it that we continue to keep electrical costs down?
Mr. Hickey.
Yes. You're absolutely right, sir. There's a lot of other factors. I just tried to lay out three key that we always have to look at, and then below that, a lot of other pieces. Electrical costs are very, very important. Power costs, utility costs are very important. More important to some industries than other industries, but important to all industries. Minnesota ranks, I think, well in certain areas, in certain communities of the state, in terms of the ability to provide reliable power at a reasonable price vis-a-vis a lot of other states. And was there a third piece of that, sir?
How important that we maintain a competitive...
Very, very important.
So this is something, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hickey, if this is something we need to keep an eye on. This is something that businesses themselves consider to be an important factor when they're making their decisions. Is that correct?
I think
Mr.
so.
Mr. Hickey.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Hickey, thank you very much. Really appreciate you taking the time to come down to the Capitol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, don't forget your PowerPoint. You need to get that out. Mr. Phil Blazer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Blazer. I'm responsible for Public Affairs and Business Development at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And in some respects, the hardest part of my presentation is complete because you can actually see what's on the screen. I always put my cross my fingers because I never know if this technology is going to cooperate with me. When I was a high school teacher in Chicago, I had trouble using film strips and overheads, so this technology is really challenging. What I want to do today is talk to you about, for a minute, about the Chamber's program called Grow Minnesota, which is our effort to encourage businesses to not only stay in Minnesota, but to grow and expand here. All of the results that I'm going to show you are on the Minnesota Chamber's website, mnchamber.com. If you look under the Grow Minnesota icon, you'll be able to not only see all of the graphs and charts that I'm going to show you right now, but there's a whole bunch more. In fact, there's a lot of analysis by region, which I think you might find particularly interesting. But let me tell you first what Grow Minnesota is and then give you the results from its second year of activity. It is, as I mentioned a minute ago, a business retention program. It's our effort to keep businesses here and growing in Minnesota. And the program operates pretty simply. It is a series of one-on-one visits. We recruit senior executives who are members of the Minnesota Chamber or members of local chambers, and we ask them to go visit. We ask them to go visit with their counterparts in businesses in their community or in their region. And I tell these volunteers when I recruit them that I think this is a really good use of their time because in the course of one visit, they get four things done. First, we go in and we thank the company for being in Minnesota and having employees here and being an active participant in our state. Minnesota businesses, garden variety companies, get very little attention like that. I can't tell you how many times the executive across the table has said to us, you're the first people to sit in that chair who didn't ask me to buy something, put my name on a list, or join something. I can't believe you're only here to say thank you. So it's a simple act, but it's an important gesture. Secondly, we find that we're matching one company with another. I visited a business in northwestern Minnesota that has a great product that couldn't figure out a way to market it to national customers. A few weeks later, I visited a company in the Twin Cities that's in the business of marketing this particular food product, or food products like this, to national accounts. We hooked up the two companies, so now the northwestern Minnesota business is doing, has accounts in parts of the country that they never dreamed of having before. So we do a little bit of matchmaking. We solve some company-specific problems, typically related to some public a unit of government, the city, the county, the school district, or the state. And it's a range of things. It's everything from a stop sign that a company wants in front of its parking lot, recently we helped a company find a new 45,000 square foot manufacturing facility. This was a good Minnesota business that was purchased, and if they didn't find a new facility quickly, that the owners would have probably moved the jobs to Illinois. So it's a real range of problem solving. And then finally, and back maybe to your mission here, and certainly to the mission of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, these visits help to inform our agenda, and you're going to see that here in a minute, I think. We've been doing this for 2 years. We're starting the third year right now. If you'll focus on the second year column, you get a quick sense of the level of the program. We have 36 local chambers of commerce participating, although we've actually done these visits in almost 50 communities. About 300 volunteer business leaders going out calling on the companies. And last year, 2005, we saw 788 businesses. It's a lot of companies, but I like to remind everybody that there are over 100,000 businesses in Minnesota, so we don't have to worry about running out of companies to stop off and see. And then maybe most importantly, and certainly surprising to us, one out of five of these visits results in some kind of follow-up activity. The stop sign example, or half a dozen occasions we've served as a mediator between a local business and their local utility to try and improve the reliability, to Representative Powell's question, the reliability of their electric service. So the problem-solving part of Grow Minnesota is a really important dimension of the program, and frankly, even when we're unsuccessful, when somebody says, could you help me do X, and we can't do it, the fact that somebody tried, we think, really does help to make that company feel a little bit better about being here in Minnesota. The map shows the communities where we've done visits. We've tried from the beginning to make this a statewide program, and we're getting there. We hope to add a few more communities every year as we work this and develop the program. As I mentioned, last year we saw almost 800 companies. This shows you the industries. A third of them are manufacturers. I want to emphasize that in no way, shape, or form is this a random sample of Minnesota businesses. The companies that we visit are purely a function of who the local chambers and their volunteers want to go see. In some communities, they saw almost entirely manufacturers. In one community, they saw almost exclusively retailers because of some concerns they had about the future of their Main Street merchants. So it varies, but statewide, it's a pretty good sample of manufacturers. Most of the companies we go see are small. Almost 60% have fewer than 50 employees. We've seen a lot of big ones as well, but we're seeing a lot of relatively small companies. This is, I think, one of the most encouraging findings of these visits. Almost two-thirds of these companies suggest that over the next 2 years, the product or the service that they produce is going to change in a substantial way. To me, it's encouraging because it shows that these businesses are looking ahead to how their markets are changing, how their customers' needs are changing, and they're adapting with the economy. Now, there's some trauma here as they adopt new processes and try to find new customers, but the fact that this economy is evolving and changing, I think, is a very healthy sign. In terms of employment over the last 2 years, again, we're seeing some positive trends. A little over half of them say they added employees the last 2 years, and only 14% report that they're workforce is smaller relative to the last 2 years. And then we kind of finally get to the question, so what are your expansion plans? Do you think in the next 3 years you're going to add to this company? And I think for many of these visits it's kind of speculation because you're asking them to look 3 years ahead, but 42% said, yeah, I think in 3 years we're going to be expanding. So then the question that begs to be asked is kind of where are you going to expand? And the good news is that 50% of these companies say that they're going to expand in the community that they're currently located. But we would be naive and really not doing our job if we didn't look at the other part of the pie chart. 15% say they're going to expand in another state. And in terms of a local chamber of commerce, 22% say they're going to be in another community. That may not be bad news for Minnesota, but if you're the Fairmont Chamber, Representative Gunther's home chamber, and you visit a company that says that they're going to expand in, God forbid, Mankato, that's, you know, you kind of want to know why. So that's the next set of questions. And really, and this is where you should probably look at the website and you can see the details. There really comes, the why comes down to kind of two kinds of answers, both with whether it's going to a Minnesota community or to another state. The first are factors unique to the business, and there it's a marketing question, meaning I'm developing a new product, and the customers that I'm aimed at are in Mankato. So I'm going to, when I build this new division, I'm going to start it in Mankato because that's where I think I can sell it first. It's also things like During the 1990s, we bought a building, a second building for this business in the Twin Cities. When the recession hit, we closed that building down, but we never sold it. And now business is better. Before I add any kind of facilities here in this community, I'm going to use the one that I own up in the Twin Cities. So that when we say factors unique to the business, that's what we mean. But the public policy issue that comes out is just the availability of land for development in the community where the business is currently located. That kind of comes to the top, although there are certainly other factors which you'll see in the report when you look at it. At the state level, there are again these factors unique to the business which are significant, but when you get to the public policy issues, the high tax status of Minnesota comes out ahead of all of the other public policy factors. I'll show you more about that in a minute as well. Whether or not the company is going to expand, we asked almost all 800 of them to give us an evaluation of various features of our economic infrastructure. And here, I'm not trying to be negative, but I know your time is limited, so I'm going to focus on the, I'm going to show you the ones that got the highest unfavorable ranking. And this is statewide. We have the same information by region, and it does vary, but economic infrastructure, when you ask them what's favorable, what they don't care about, what's unfavorable, highway infrastructure, air service, meaning air transportation service, and the availability of buildings come to the top or go to the bottom, depending on how you want to think about an unfavorable. What is important and significant, I think, is that the air service issue crops up, and frankly, when you look at this regionally, it's almost entirely in greater Minnesota and specific regions of the state. And what we've discovered is that there are a whole bunch of good, growing, greater Minnesota companies that are shipping stuff all over the world or having their employees go to see customers, and the availability of a scheduled airline service is more important to them. In many places, it's more important than the roads and the bridges. When you come into the Twin Cities, roads, bridges, and transit. And I think that's what's driving those two columns. When we ask about the cost of doing business, this is the public policy factors here. This is we're asking all of the companies. Before, we were only asking the ones that said they were going to expand in the next 3 years, what the factors were affecting the location of their expansion. But we did ask every company about the cost factors, and here, and I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody, healthcare costs are far and away the biggest concern. And I see this when I present this information, when the state chamber did its recent round of policy meetings in January with our members, the cost of healthcare is far and away the greatest concern of businesses statewide right now. But you can see that state taxes, whether these companies were going to expand or not, that gets a pretty high unfavorable. And interestingly, and I would not have guessed this, workers' compensation shows up. And I'm speculating, but my sense is that there's a link between health care and work comp, and that when somebody gets injured at work, they end up in the healthcare system. Those high healthcare costs are not only pushing up the premium on the health insurance, but I think they're also pushing up the premium on the work comp insurance. And to the extent that we can be successful in dealing with the cost issues of healthcare, I think we could probably also make some progress on work comp as well. We asked about some local cost factors, and here local taxes show up, not to the extent that the state taxes do. But the reason I want to show you this is the sort of second place. It's kind of a dead heat, if you will, between the availability or the cost of land, I should say, the cost of housing, energy costs, and the cost of labor. And what will be interesting, again, maybe to Representative Powell's point, we're going to keep doing these visits and keep asking about the same cost factors. There are a variety of things changing in our energy system and with our utilities If I had to guess right now, I think that energy will rise as a concern because of what's going on with electric bills in many parts of the state right now. But right now, the biggest concern appears to be local taxes, although not nearly to the extent that businesses are concerned about the state taxes. Just a couple other things there. We asked, in the next year, do you expect to add employment? And here you can see that a significant number of companies say that they will be adding employees, about 55%. But, and this, we kind of probed this a little bit and asked if they expect recruiting problems, and are the recruiting problems related to the industry, meaning I'm in the printing industry and nobody's training any printers? Or is it related to the community? I'm running a printing operation in Sleepy Eye, and they're just our community. There aren't any other printers, so there's nobody to hire from. So we want to understand kind of what they perceive their difficulty is in recruiting people. But what's most significant, I think, is the kind of jobs that these businesses anticipate having difficulty finding. We've read a lot about this the last few months. These visits confirm it's precision workers. Anybody who's working in a manufacturing, tool and die, machining, those kinds of precision workers, professionals as well. But there's a real businesses see a real challenge ahead of themselves in filling these precision manufacturing type jobs. And so finally, when we finish the visit, we ask ourselves the question, what's the likelihood that this company will pick up stakes and just leave? So forget about whether or not they're going to expand. What's the likelihood that they'll just pick up stakes and go, you know, to Georgia or go to Wisconsin? The good news here is that when you leave after the visit, 89% of the time, the conclusion is that we think that's highly unlikely, that the company might not expand, you know, in Hibbing, but they're not going to pick up stakes and leave, okay? So that's good news, and we ought to celebrate that. But then you look at the other part of the wheel, the 11%, and those are companies, frankly, that we need to spend more time with. We, the state chamber, the local chambers, plan to go back, touch bases back with those companies, because for a variety of reasons, when the people doing the visit left the meeting, they thought that there was either a high or a moderate chance that that company might not stay in the community, that they might leave altogether. And if you want, I can give you some of the factors that drove them to reach that conclusion. But so there's good news here, but 11% of 800, that's a pretty big number. That's a bunch of companies that not only can't the state afford to lose, but from our perspective, with a little bit of work, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to keep those companies. And then finally, in terms of the year two results of Grow Minnesota, just to recap, the key thing here, the most important feature of the program, is to go out and to say thank you to these companies. We did that with 788 of them in 2005. Our hope is to do at least that number in 06 and hopefully more. One out of five of them needed some kind of help. We were able to be responsive. I think every time we did that, we're again building the bond between the company and the community. And then back to the Minnesota Chamber agenda, these visits feed into and affect the issues that we work on. We've been working on healthcare, but everything that we learned in the Grow Minnesota visit suggests that we need to continue that effort. Transportation, we're working hard right now to get lineup support to pass the motor vehicle sales tax constitutional amendment. Everything in the Grow Minnesota visit suggests that that's time well spent. Taxes, you saw that at the local level and the state level. The idea of not having any general fund tax increases is something that we have to continue to push. And more attention to workers' comp. We need to understand what's driving that concern. If it's health care, I think that's a reason to double the effort on trying to deal with health care costs. And then finally, the workforce issues. You'll see over the next several months that our organization will spend more time looking at the various workforce development, education, and job training programs, because clearly there are some questions there that employers are asking that first we need to sort out, and then hopefully be prepared to come back to the extent that the answers relate to public policy and make some suggestions to the governor and the legislature probably in the 2007 session. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm happy to try and answer questions.
So we got time for just a few brief questions because we do have a lot of people waiting to testify. Representative Surge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great presentation. Hibbing was one, I think, the first chamber to get on board and start asking these questions. I have talked a lot with the chamber. It's been helpful to get this data for the state, but then broken down by region and actually individual chambers of commerce. It's been a wonderful tool, and I think there's a lot of good news here. I'm glad you waited until your third or first fourth slide to say taxes are the issue, the major issue. I commend you on not having that first slide.
Actually, health care.
And that's actually where I'm going with this, is one of your first slides is that taxes is a major issue. So I really have two questions for you. When you're talking about 42% of businesses want to expand, and the majority of them in Minnesota, whether they be from Fairmont to Mankato, but in Minnesota is great. And because sometimes they're going to expand from Chisholm to Hibbing or vice versa, and I'm fine with that as long as they stay in Minnesota. Are they aware of the Job Z program? Are they utilizing it? Because the data sometimes says, you know, we're having trouble expanding because of land and taxes. I thought we took care of that in the last few sessions with Job Z, that those should not be issues. So when we're still getting that from the business community, that taxes are an issue, and we've kind of zeroed it out for the next 10 years, I see a disconnect there. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Mr. Blazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sturridge, anybody who's doing a major expansion, they know about Job Z. They're also they're using it. But a lot of these companies, you know, most of the companies we saw have fewer than 50 employees, relatively small. For them, if they expand in your community, they might add two or three. They're not thinking that they didn't maybe be eligible for that kind of a program. And in some respects, it's kind of a curious thing. As helpful as the JobZ program is, it makes some of these other companies that are going to grow more incrementally more sensitive to the tax bill that they're paying, because they don't see those special programs like JobZ within their grasp. So their comment to us is, well, you got to just do something about the overall tax burden, because I'm going to grow little bits at a time. Nobody's ever going to, you know, is going to ever give me a tax abatement or whatever. So as helpful as the Jobs Lead program is, in some respects, it makes some of the smaller businesses kind of scratch their head and say, well, you know, what about me?
Representative Rukunia.
I share that concern with you, and as you know, and most of the folks on the table know, it's not just how many employees, it's how much capital you're putting into the project as well could qualify you for this. So I'm just hoping that you don't have Minnesota businesses out there not utilizing
it. Mr. Chair, Representative Surge, our advice is, even if it's two or three employees or they're just adding a machine, it takes 3 minutes. I can call the economic development director for you, or you can call. But let's say I went to visit a company in a community that will remain nameless where they were under construction, adding a really nice addition, going to add all kinds of employees, great company. And the CEO asked me if I thought that they would qualify. And I said, well, I don't think so, because you're already under construction. But it takes 2 minutes to ask. And we did. And the economic development director said, well, they're about a year too late. So, but at least we asked, and they appreciate that.
They have on the list Representative Rukavina, Paul, Mullery, Moe, and Goodwin. So we're going to have to move fairly quickly to get through everybody. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blazer, you've got on your slide there that you're shaping up the 06 business agenda. You want the motor vehicle sales tax totally dedicated. I had actually this morning, very timely, one of my constituents from Virginia called me and said, I don't know what the chamber is thinking. We have a new chamber now. We used to have four chambers in Mount Vernon,
right.
Virginia, Everett, and Gilbert. Now we have the Laurentian Chamber, so I only have one meeting that I have to snub instead of four, which is okay. Anyhow, a lot of my business people are still Democrats because they know Democrats help Main Street businesses, and they were confused about this motor vehicle sales tax because they're smart enough to know that if, you know, I don't know what percentage is being dedicated to transportation, all this stuff, but who's on the transportation committee here? Anybody? But anyhow,
some of it's already.
Yeah, I mean, my question is this. I don't know how many millions that takes out of the general fund. Hundreds of millions.
400. I think 300.
300 million. So now you're going to take $300 million out of the general fund, and your next bullet is no increase in general fund sources. So is this no trucker left behind, or what's the deal here? Because I'm tired of these programs where you ask us to spend $300 million and then you pretend that you didn't spend $300 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brooke, it's an interesting coincidence that this morning I was in Virginia.
I know, and you talked them into it, and when you left, they all said, hey, that guy's nuts. They realized it.
And then they called
when you left.
They called you, and then as they called you, they called me.
No.
I got them all framed around.
You had gone, and then they figured it out. Wait a second.
You better go back up there.
Yeah, I'm on my way. But actually, the amendment calls for the phase-in to occur over 4 years, and our judgment, looking at the revenue forecast and the growth of the other general fund taxes, is we acknowledge that $300 million is a chunk out of the general fund, no question. But we've got 4 years of growth in the other revenue sources that we think will more than make up for the $300 million.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brazier, that doesn't make me feel very comfortable, because in 2001, the Chamber said there was enough growth in this state that billion-dollar dedication of general fund money for education in places like Edina and Eden Prairie that didn't get education dollars, that the growth was going to keep up. So when it didn't, you took our LGA away from us, you cut our school districts, you cut funding for second languages, you tried to do that, we cut Minnesota Care, we did everything. So, you know, the Chamber wants good roads, and I commend them for that. The Chamber, I think, supported, maybe I'm wrong, the gasoline tax. Am I wrong on that one? Or did you support it last?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, we supported a 5-cent fuel
tax. And you supported that?
Yes, supported.
Okay, well then why don't you be honest and do that? But you can't take $400 or $300 million out of the general fund and spend it on something where it isn't being spent on. Your next bullet says no increase in general fund sources, which I take to mean, let's put it, we'll have the lawyers in the legislature, 40 of them already, represent Cole and represent Mallory, 40 out of 201. See, here's my theory. The teachers should get together, like the lawyers did in the legislature. Every year, when we've been cutting every other finance bill, the judiciary finance bill has gone up 16-18% with fees and fines. Now, here's what the teachers should do. The kid gets a D in school, $1,000 fine. $2,000, too fat to go to gym class, that's just $500. You know, because that's what we're doing here. We keep doing, I forgot about Representative Atkins down there, I'm sorry, another attorney. And, so, to pretend that you can pull $300 million out of the general fund, and then the next bullet, no increase in general fund, implies to me, you're meaning you're going to find some new ways to get fees and whatever else on your own business people on Main Street. Because you can't do what you're saying you can do up there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, first, our members have been understand the implications of the motor vehicle sales tax amendment. They know that it's going to affect the general fund. They place a higher priority on that spending and dedicating money to those purposes than others. But the other thing as well is all you have to do is open up the November forecast and look at the rate of growth in the revenues from our graduated income tax, from our corporate income tax, our sales tax, our statewide property tax. All of those revenue sources are growing, and they're growing at a rate that even if you pull the $300 million out in 4 years from now, or 4 years after the election, the size of the general fund will be revenue-wise will be substantially bigger than it is today.
Representative, we got a long list of people who want to ask questions.
Mr. Brazier, it's 4 years, almost going on five now after 2001, and that's just what you told us back then, and it didn't work. And for 4 years, we cut everything in this state.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's go to health care costs. Over the last couple of years, this legislature, and I think a lot of times on a bipartisan effort, have worked awful hard to try to bring down costs. And we've done things like enabling consumer-driven health care type legislation, like health savings accounts. We've passed flexible benefit plans, just for two examples. Now, are these going to be helpful for business, and do the businesses seem to be utilizing this? And is this something that the chamber's trying to sell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, we think they will be helpful. The flexible benefits bill that passed in 2005, I think that is just being taken out to the market now. I spoke with an insurance broker yesterday on my way to Virginia, was really not. I was surprised that this broker wasn't as aware of it as I thought she should be. So one thing that we need to do is to work harder to publicize those programs. But the encouraging thing, or one encouraging thing, I heard a speech yesterday morning by the chief operating officer of Blue Cross Blue Shield, and her estimates were that at least for their insured population, that their increases would be under 10% and substantially so. I think she, said some people think 9, others think it'll be closer to 7. So I think we're headed in the right direction. It's still an urgent problem, but I think we're making some progress.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blazer, just a question on one of your slides going back. You had, I think it was 11% that were considering expanding elsewhere, and I just wanted to clarify. For instance, I was at a retreat with about a dozen CFOs and CEOs a couple of weeks ago for 6 hours, and there's two of us that weren't. But almost every one of them, two-thirds of them were expanding, and not in Minnesota, but it was not anything. All of them said there was a problem in Minnesota on lack of turnout of science and technical degrees, but none of them had that as a reason why they were expanding. They were all expanding because of markets for their business in elsewhere that they needed to be close to. And so I'm wondering, in your 11% that would go out, if they just gave a general, we're going out, that's a lot different from what every single one of these said that they were. They're going to stay their main one here, but they're going out to other places because of the general market they need to get to. So was there that distinction in your 11% or not?
Mr. Blazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, there is that distinction. That's why I divide the reasons between the business specific. When there's something specific to the business, it is a marketing or a product related rationale. And developing a new product, want to get closer to the market. And I separate that out from the public policy driven features. And it's when you get to the public policy side that the tax issues become prominent.
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. In your 11%, I'm just trying to find out from your 11%, did that specifically distinguish those two kinds of situations?
Mr. Blazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, it does. The business-specific reasons are more prominent than the public policy reasons, and when you see the report, you'll be able to see the difference.
Well, I'll get it later.
Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Blazer, when you were up in Bemidji here last week, you had a pretty good reception, in particular on the Smart Buy Alliance, and I heard about that from some constituents They weren't too pleased with your position on our local option sales tax, but this one you found some friends with. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how much the support you're getting from, in particular, small businesses. When I talk to small businesses, even more than property tax increases, that's their biggest issue. If you're getting a good reception on that, then, and how much you think that might reduce their, or at least keep level their health care costs.
Mr. Blazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, I think there's pretty strong support among smaller businesses for opportunities to kind of pool their risk and then buy coverage collectively. They're looking for mechanisms or ways to do that. And I'll be the first to admit it's easier to say that than to do it. It gets to be pretty complicated. They're also excited and interested in getting more information on the quality of the providers in the community and what they charge. The idea is to get their employees and their families more engaged and more active shoppers for healthcare. And I think statewide there's good support for that. There's some frustration, not so much maybe in Bemidji as in some smaller communities, that, you know, in our town there just aren't that many providers, and how much shopping can we really do? And I'd argue that even in the smallest community where there might only be one or two providers, if one does a better job than the other, we, employers, and certainly our employees, are better off if we can get them to go to the better provider. It's better care, and it costs less. So reception has been good statewide.
Just a follow, Mr. Sherman. Then you got a sense of the cost reduction. Is there going to be a lack or a slow in the growth of costs for these businesses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, I think it's more realistic to think about slowing the rate of inflation, and it's difficult to say. I know that the estimates of the amount of unnecessary and effective care that gets provided today, depending on who you ask, range between 20% and 30%. So we can slow that rate of healthcare inflation quite considerably if we can get people focused on the best providers, the one that follow practice guidelines and standards.
Okay, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. Mr. Blazer, I'm interested in, and not at all surprised that the number one issue for your businesses was health care. What I'd like to know, and because there have been many changes in the legislature in the past few years to make it easier, supposedly, for businesses to get health care, and as we know, so far, we haven't had a big change in health care costs or inflationary increases or anything. I know some of these programs are just getting implemented. But I also have talked to a number of small businesses and family-owned businesses, and they're not real infatuated with this health care savings account net because they are competing with big businesses for employees, number one, and the big businesses are still offering halfway decent health care. And they have every reason to want good health care rather than limited benefit health care, as their employees do, because it's going to be covering them as well. So I'm interested if you talk to them at all about becoming involved in Minnesota Care as a group, or I don't understand what your Smart Buy Alliance is, so I don't know what that is different from what we've already done here, except I understand the pooling issue of businesses pulling together to get lower costs, but that we've been talking about for 25 years, and I don't know who's preventing that from happening or why that isn't being done. But what I really want to know is, did they talk about health care, that it was unaffordable, that it was unaccessible, that they needed to get better coverage? What were the issues there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, mostly it was issue of affordability. Just to get coverage, what is it going to cost? And a lot of smaller businesses and frankly larger ones as well are moving to health savings accounts because they see it not as a way of giving less coverage or inferior coverage, but see it as a way of getting the employee, the employee's family, more engaged as an active shopper or consumer of health care. And if that's the only change we make, that's not sufficient. We need also to work hard at getting, and this is where the Smart Buy Alliance comes in, is getting more information and better information available to me and my family so that when I need to pick a provider, I can make it based on the quality of that provider. And so simply, so these smaller companies, they're clearly restructuring their benefits, but they're also looking to be able to provide more information to their employees, and they hope that the combination will result in something that's more affordable for everybody.
Mr. Blazer, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've got to get through some people here. There's some people that want to get out of here by 3. We're going to go to Laura Eklund from L&M Radiator. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Eckholm, and I am with L&M Radiator, an industrial radiator and heat exchanger manufacturer headquartered in Hibbing. Commissioner Wilson asked me to come today and talk to you and to tell you our story. We're a family-owned company, and we're just beginning about our 49th year of operations. We have manufacturing plants located in Hibbing, El Paso, Texas, Perth, Western Australia, and most recently, Independence, Iowa. We're also 49% owner of a plant in Hermosillo, Sonora, Mexico. We make big heat exchangers for big off-highway equipment, primarily for the mining and oil and gas industries. We started exclusively serving the Iron Range in the mining industry in northern Minnesota, and about 30 years ago became a worldwide concern. In the past 2 years, our business has more than doubled. In Hibbing, we hired 59 new employees last year. We have 250 employees. We work 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, with 3 separate shifts. Last year, actually, exactly 1 year ago, we had a management planning committee meeting and determined that we needed to expand in the next 3 to 5 years due to the level of our business. We were at physical capacity, or close to, in most of our manufacturing facilities. Also at that meeting, we determined that we were not going to expand in Minnesota. Even though our headquarters was in Minnesota, we were not going to expand in Minnesota. By March, just 2 months later, our business had increased to the point that where we needed to expand immediately. It became my job to determine where we were going to expand, what state we were going to go to. We wanted to be in North America, or actually in the United States. Earlier I stated that we decided not to expand in Minnesota, and I guess I'd like to explain why. Everybody in my family was raised here. We like it here, but we're here by choice. When we started out 50 years ago, we were here because 100% of our business was on the Iron Range. Right now, less than 1% of our business is in Minnesota. I think that some of our primary considerations are some of the things that you've already talked about today. What makes doing business in Minnesota difficult? The business climate isn't the best. It's a high tax environment. It's a high workers' comp insurance state. State law is heavily favored towards employees. And the immediate concern for us in Hibbing, which is probably a good thing, is the availability of a high-quality labor force. There's very high employment, not unemployment, in Hibbing right now, and there has been for the past couple of years. So trying to hire qualified workers in Hibbing was becoming it continues to be a very, very big challenge for us. So looking for a state where we had a good supply of quality laborers was a big important factor for us. And number 2 was a good state for doing business. In March, we started first exploring in Texas because we have the plant there in El Paso. They were not very helpful. And you need to keep in mind, this isn't my full-time job. I have a full-time job, but we needed to expand, and I pulled the short straw, I think. We looked in New Mexico. Because we had a vendor there, and they were eager to have us maybe venture up with them and try to expand in New Mexico. And then I happened to be at a trade show, National Association of Manufacturers trade show in March, and ran into a group from Iowa. They just had a booth there, and they said, we can help you find a place to expand in Iowa. Iowa is where you want to be. You send us your qualifications, and we'll find potential sites for you. So I thought, that sounds pretty easy, but I was pretty skeptical. So in by April, I had sent them a letter with all of our specifications, and they were very specific specifications. By May, we had 16 applications from 16 different communities in Iowa, all of whom met our qualifications. By the end of May and June, we had narrowed that to 5 communities and went on a two-day tour to 3 of the 4 corners of the state of Iowa. In July, we chose the city of Independence, which is about 20 miles east of Waterloo, and we opened in September. We are leasing existing building from the County Development Authority, and there's a big expansion underway that will be completed next month. What worked for us in this instance was how easy it was. And what was really striking for me was that the coordinated effort. Every single site visit that we went to and every communication that we had was coordinated. The city and or the County Development Authority was there. I met more mayors than I've ever met in my life. They brought in the state agency. This group that we started working with is the Iowa Area Development Group, which is a set up by the Rural Electric Authority, all the different rural electric authorities combined, and they wanted to bring more businesses into the state to pump up their electrical usage. Bankers were there. They were said, if you need to borrow money, we can help you with that. Contractors were there. High schools and the community colleges were there saying that they would help us provide training. Local chambers of commerce were there. Vendors were there. Business people were there. It was really one-stop shopping for us. When we went on our investigation for a new location, incentives were not our primary consideration. However, in Iowa, that was also one-stop shopping. We filled out one application, and that qualified us for, potentially a number of different financing sources, and we have taken advantage of one or two of those. Another thing that struck us in Iowa, there was a supply of ready trained workers. We had a job fair in August. 120 applicants came. Independence is 6,000 people, so that was a huge encouraging factor for us. In Iowa, there are lower state taxes. We only pay state taxes on what we sell there. Versus in Minnesota, we pay taxes on everything that we manufacture here. There's a more balanced state law for employers. It's a much lower workers' comp state, and it was easy. By the end of this year, we'll be half the size of we are in Hibbing in Iowa. I met with Bill Blazer and Commissioner Kramer, and they said, how much did you explore Minnesota? And quite frankly, we didn't explore very much based on the factors that I talked about. I guess that's just kind of, that's our story, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Yeah. Member questions?
No.
Representative Wall.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. Did you approach Deed here in Minnesota at all? And if not, maybe somebody else here could answer. I would assume that Minnesota would provide that same set of services, and if we don't, we should.
Is that come?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we did not approach Deed, and I certainly wasn't aware if there is one-stop shopping here. We did not get very much attention from the local community, and just one more, comment on that. I don't know if it was Representative Sturgis or Representative Rukavina asked about Job Z's. That whole Job Z thing, we did talk about that with our with the folks from the city of Hibbing, and our understanding of that is it doesn't work for us at all unless we want to completely relocate to off of our campus in Hibbing, and so that kind of is a detriment, I guess, or something that made us kind of cranky, actually, that there are other businesses that can come into Hibbing and get some real estate tax advantages that we can't qualify for unless we choose to relocate off of land that we already own.
Representative Gunther?
Just a follow-up.
Sorry,
this is my business card here. If you choose to expand again, please give me a call and I'll talk to you about Bemidji.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you do expand your business in Minnesota, you can qualify for a job zone in Minnesota at your existing plant site. And that is possible. And since you've already done it, it doesn't do a lot of good to go say it, but I would love to see the difference between what the program you got, besides self-satisfaction that I'm sure you got, because I live right next to Iowa, and they aren't bad folks. I think we do have a pretty complete, comprehensive program for expansions as well as relocations, and we're really, really doing well getting Iowa businesses into Minnesota. So it would be nice to know what the differences were, so you, that wouldn't do you any good anyway. But maybe in the future, if you want to look at it, we'd be glad to show it to you. No sales tax, no property tax, no state income tax. Anybody you pay over $30,000 a year, we give you 7% of the incremental amount over $30,000. Just a pretty comprehensive plan.
Mr. Chairman,
because they're women, they're qualified women.
Until today, I had no idea that was how jobs would work, and we were specifically told by the folks in Hibbing that we would have to relocate to one or two spots in Hibbing that were designated jobs and it is very useful to know because we are still, I mean, we added 59 jobs last year, and we're going to probably be doing an expansion on our existing site in Hibbing. We are incredibly busy, and that's a fact that, you know, maybe I should have called Deed, but that's not a fact that we hid from the local folks in Hibbing.
If you'd rather call Bob Gunther, please get my card before you leave.
Okay.
I'm right next to Iowa.
Representative Mueller, and then we need to move to the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But by the way, while he said he likes Iowa folks, but he did close to one of the Gunther grocery chain the stores in Iowa. So I have a question on something you said. You said something about, and we were trying to figure out what you meant by that you pay a tax on everything produced, not on what you sell. What? I've never heard of such a tax.
Back home, does that have to do with single sales factor?
There's a few people here on this tax committee, and I don't think any of us figure out.
Sales. I think Iowa adopted single sales factor, and I don't know if we adopted that.
Ours is
fully
mostly
phased in. We're partway there.
You're talking about single sales. Oh, yeah. Iowa's followed like us. Okay.
No, I think Iowa's further than us. Heads are nodding from people who are on the tax. I'm formerly on the tax committee, so I was up on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we whatever's manufactured in Hibbing and in Minnesota and that we make money on, which is the goal, we pay taxes on. And that I understand that there's some changes. I don't know if they've been implemented. I know they certainly aren't implemented, or 100% today in Iowa. It's just whatever is sold in the state of Iowa.
Mr. Chairman, it's not on production. It's based on number of employees and property, are the other two factors. Dominant. Not production. So production has nothing to do with it.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. The next, I think, is a panel. Right. Those three together. Robert Heiss, Jay Valentin, and Doug Anton.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Please introduce yourselves as you each of you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Robert Heiss. I'm the president of the Minnesota Associated Builders and Contractors. And I'm joined here with Mr. Valentin. Jay, you want to state your name?
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Jay Valentin with Cedar Lake Electric out of Faribault.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Peterson. I'm with Starcon International out of Manhattan, Illinois.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have some real business people with us today, an electrical contractor and a high-pressure piping contractor who have stories to tell about doing business here in Minnesota, so I think you're going to hear their stories, and I think you're going to find them valuable. We'll only try to take about 10 minutes of your time. I know you have a busy agenda, and I'd like to stick to the economics of the issue as opposed to the politics of the issue, and I think you can understand that from a business perspective today. But Minnesota is an island. Minnesota is an island in the area of how they calculate their prevailing wage. No other state in the union nor the federal government calculates prevailing wage like we do. Now, what is prevailing wage? Well, in 1973, Minnesota decided to adopt the Little Davis-Bacon Act, right? And that's basically involves the construction industry in 87 counties. So you'll do a survey of different crafts, different professions in the area, and you come up with a number. And that number then is applied to all public work that receives any state funding. Forget about the federal stuff today. That applies to all work that receives any state funding. I think we have a better way of doing that. Let me tell you some of the problems with the way we calculate prevailing wage today in Minnesota. Basically, it ends up being 30% higher, 30% higher than the market rate. So there's nothing prevailing about prevailing wage in Minnesota. It's really not reflective of typical rates. And why is that? It's because of the calculation. We're not asking this committee, or we won't be asking the state legislature, to throw out prevailing wage in the upcoming session, but we will be asking you to look at the calculation and find a better way to do it. Here's how it's done today. Guy gets paid $10 an hour. Guy gets paid $11 an hour. Guy gets paid $12 an hour. Two ladies get paid $14 an hour. One guy gets paid $15 an hour. Every other state and the federal government would add that up and divide by six. That would be your weighted average. We don't do it that way. The prevailing wage in Minnesota would be $14 an hour. $14 an hour. That's not where we want to be. There's other problems, inherent problems, with the way we calculate this wage today. It only takes two rates, two people reporting, to set the rate. That's not good. Last thing I want to say about the way we do it, and then I'm going to get into the better way, and I think you have a study in front of you. The last thing I want to say about the way we calculate it is we don't know what the response rate is. When I talk to the Department of Labor and Industry, they think it's somewhere between 20 and 25%, but it's never been tested. So we have no way of measuring what the response rate is. So statistically, I guess you could say it could be invalid. Okay, the better way is the way we're recommending, and we think, and the study says, and the study was done by the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, February 2005, we've provided you the executive summary, Mr. Chair, and we have the whole study if anyone's interested in the numbers. But the study says we can save $126 to $171 million annually in the state of Minnesota if we go to the deed way. And what's the deed way? The deed way is using occupational employment statistical survey information. This is probably the most comprehensive survey the state does, and it measures the median wage rates. The median wage rates, what prevails in a market area. It makes perfect sense. And the beauty about this is it's already being done. We don't have to do it through the Department of Labor and Industry any longer. It would be a consolidation of services at the state level and save us all this money. It's wider distribution, and get this. Remember I said it only takes two people to set the rate in any area for a classification? Deed does this quarterly. Department of Labor and Industry only does their survey annually. They do theirs quarterly, and they will not publish a classification unless there's a 75% response rate. It's beautiful. Statistically, you can't beat it. I'm thinking the way we do prevailing wage today in Minnesota is probably invalid if anyone would ever test the information, but no one's ever done that. So I guess in closing, I would ask members of the committee and you, Mr. Chair, to take a hard look at how Minnesota could become more competitive by not throwing prevailing wage out. No one wants to do that. No one wants to cheat the worker. But we do want a representative market rate and not some kind of super minimum wage rate. And you know what? Let's just do it in one area. Let's test job Z zones. Let's test job Z zones, because you go around the state, you talk to people in that community, and guess why it's not working? That's why I have my friend here today with me. Job Z isn't working. It's a myth. And I'll tell you why it's not working. Because prevailing wage rates, now you know the problem with them, right? I've explained it, exist on job Z zones. Mr. Valentine's going to explain to you what happened and his experience with job Z. And this is pertaining to our discussion on prevailing wage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just to continue conversation about the job Z, Governor Pawlenty started this program to foster growth and retain of existing businesses, as well as encourage new businesses to relocate here by forgiving taxes to these companies during the job Z period of approximately 12 years, which I believe sunsets in 2013. Several communities and companies dived in and signed up for the program at the start. Late in 2004, Attorney General Hatch formed an opinion that it was a subsidy and therefore should be subject to prevailing wage. This was not the intent of Governor Pawlenty. Since this opinion has been rendered, some projects have gone forward and also started with this requirement. But on the flip side, projects have been stopped, abandoned, and forced to go back and pay back wages on existing projects. Most recently, I was here earlier with the Amphenol people, and there were several representatives here that were in front of you sharing these same concerns. One of the House committee members said that it's not a big deal to require this prevailing wage because they're getting so many forms of tax relief. I disagree, and I'll give you an example. A firm in Fairland, Minnesota, Sage Electrochromics, recently built a new facility, and we're grateful for their decision to move there. It was completed prior to the AG's opinion. It was calculated that if the cost of additional $300 would be subject to them due to prevailing wage, they indicated they would now be in South Dakota had they been required to pay the prevailing wage. Also, due to the prevailing wage requirements, it makes it difficult for local contractors to compete with metro contractors on projects within their communities due to constraints within the law. These wages are not representative of areas where work is performed specifically in outstate areas. If businesses such as Sage are required to pay prevailing wages, some may stay, some may go, and others may never come to Minnesota, similar to the L&M story we just heard recently. I think it's imperative to make sure that Minnesota be competitive in all aspects of keeping Minnesota companies here and encouraging companies from outside of Minnesota to locate here. In order to continue an aggressive campaign by Minnesota, I believe that we should not require prevailing wage on the projects, and it's an important issue, and we really should consider repealing this opinion formed by the AG. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I say, and members of the committee, our discussion here today was about the current calculations of prevailing wage. Our other guest, Tom Peterson from StarCon, has another regulatory issue that has impacted his company here in Minnesota. Would you like to hear that now? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
That would be great.
Ms. Peterson, Tom,
please introduce yourself.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson once again. I am currently the Director of Quality and Regulatory Affairs for StarCon International. I've had 37 years in the business of contracting. I'm a mechanical engineer, was educated at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas. In 2001, Marathon, at that time it was Marathon National Petroleum, came to StarCon because of some of the work we've done in some of their associated plants throughout the country. Our expertise is in heavy construction, in the refining, petrochemical, and chemical industries. We're experts in pressure vessels, high-pressure piping, engineering, construction of all phases. We work all over the world. We came to Marathon over in St. Paul Park in 2001 to look at some of the programs that they had and some of the projects they had ongoing and forthcoming. We were asked to sit down and provide them with a package of rates, qualifications, our safety record, and basically our business plan and how we do business throughout the United States as a contractor. One of the things that was really, really enticing and pleasing to the Marathon people was our safety record above anything and everything. We also have a program within our organization called the Star Partners where we can go in and evaluate performance standards within a given facility and judge their productive records and their productivity through an outside third-party affiliation. And to cut a long story short, we sat down and we worked through several things that led us to believe we had a good thing going and we could maintain and develop a relationship with Marathon St. Paul. Now, Marathon St. Paul is not one of the most productive refining systems within the Marathon organization. So what they were looking to do is tighten their belts, become more competitive, strengthen their profitability within the organization, and protect their position within the community. And expand was a vision of theirs. It still is a vision of theirs. We went forward with everything and started dealing with the regulatory departments within the state of Minnesota. No problems until we hit the Department of Labor and Industry in your HPP division, High Pressure Piping Division. We have consistently maintained a workforce of about 1,000 employees that are very, very competent, very, very high qualified, and knowledgeable in their endeavors of discipline. We have gone through every regulatory process within all 48 states, 50 states, including Hawaii and Alaska, and met all of their requirements, passed all of their exams, and fulfilled every jurisdictional and regulatory requirement of that state and complied with it, and have never fallen out of compliance. One of the things that we found here in the state of Minnesota is the sector of your regulatory affairs, which deals with the qualification of a high-pressure pipe fitter or high-pressure piping pipe fitter. We like to go into a community and hire and get our resources within that community. We have been unable to fulfill these resources required by the state because, to be honest with you, you have very few pipe fitters in the state of Minnesota that are merit shop employees that hold the credentials required by the High Pressure Piping Department. It's been extremely difficult. We've solicited, put out countless ads, trying to incorporate and trying to bring into our employment people with these credentials. We've also sent through the High Pressure Piping Testing Department numerous applicants that have tested and have failed your test. I myself took the test for the contractor's exam. I went in cold turkey on the first exam, what I thought was real prepared on the second exam, and what I went in with a photographic memory on the third exam and passed it. I went into the exam looking for something that tested one's competency rather than one's knowledge of a process. And we're just having an extremely difficult time with this type of testing as administered by the state. We've been very successful in every other state, and in every other state that we've ever tested in or followed this type of situation, the testing has always been third-party given and has been structured to the competent of whatever discipline that you're testing in, not whether or not the knowledge of one's knowledge of a certain process, whether it be ammonia, steam, power generation, or refining. A piece of pipe is a piece of pipe, and we thought we would go into this state being tested on our competency and knowledge on fitting the pipe, welding the pipe, and constructing the pipe. We're at odds on what we can do to rectify the situation, and that's been our only stumbling block in this state. And we've really, really gone through an attrition rate and extreme restriction out there at Marathon. We can do the job if given the opportunity to do it. Thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Mullery and then Representative Gunther, and then we have to move to the next witness so that we can get the people out of here that need to keep up with their schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. First one is of you. I didn't realize that we were going to get into prevailing wage today, and if I'd have known that, I would have had some people show up that would take. I'm sure that one statement made was incorrect, but there, if you would be open to at some time in the future having a somebody from the other side and maybe somebody that actually is involved with it, for instance, for MnDOT or something where they have a lot of experience. And then my question for Mr. Heiss. Do you said you don't want to get rid of prevailing wage. Do you support a real enforcement of prevailing wage across the board, just like they do, for instance, with MnDOT? MnDOT, I think, is considered to be pretty fair about enforcement of prevailing wage. Do you support that across the board?
Mr. Heiss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, as you know, in the state of Minnesota, the prevailing wage is set by the Department of Labor, and in the case of MnDOT, they act as the enforcement agency. I'm not here today questioning enforcement. I'm here suggesting a new way to calculate the outcomes.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, I was just asking if you support. You were making statements about prevailing wage and what you'd like to see. Do you support a real enforcement of it, just as MnDOT does?
I don't see a problem. Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, no problem with enforcement.
Sure. Representative Mullery, with regard to your question, I didn't tell people what they can and cannot say. It was just totally up to them. So if a bill comes up on that during session, with the limited time we have, we'll have people testify from both sides. Representative Gunther, do you have a question?
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask about the Attorney General's ruling on prevailing wage with job zones. And I was wondering if Wisconsin adopted the same legislation that Minnesota has with job zones with their prevailing wage, which is weighted averages instead of the modal system that we use. And it's my understanding they did around the border of Wisconsin because there was a considerable leakage of businesses from there. So Attorney General Hatch's ruling is sending greater Minnesota jobs to Wisconsin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've got a couple witnesses that have to get going, Representative Rukavina, and I appreciate that this subject could keep us here for literally hours. And if a bill comes up on it, we will have full time to discuss it, I promise you.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Just to the political statement by Representative Gunther. You know.
Have you ever done that?
Oh, I have. But I've always let you respond.
Briefly, Representative Rukavina.
Well, I'm just, you know, I don't know Mr. Heiss. A few years ago, 2 years ago, I think it was, maybe three, when we looked at what the prevailing wage was in certain parts of rural Minnesota, for a laborer, it's like $7.80 an hour. And for an electrician, it's like $12 an hour in certain counties. If you think that's unreasonable, then I have to strongly disagree with you, sir, because I don't have those figures. If I had known prevailing wage was going to come up today, Mr. Rice, I'd have those figures there. But it's kind of embarrassing when people say that under this, using the mode system, where we're even talking about $8, $9 an hour in wages, that it's too much. And I don't know, I don't think any plant, Representative Gunther, of any kind has gone to Wisconsin or will go to Wisconsin because of prevailing wage. But I will say one thing I'll predict about job Z zones is that at the end of 12 years or 10 years, whatever this law is, that these companies that want to come somewhere because they don't want to pay any taxes
or don't want to pay any prevailing wage will never pay taxes, because when their deal's up in 10 years, they'll say, give us another break or we're going. And I think the job Z-Zone, for the life of me, I never understood how the chamber could support it when one business is paying the taxes of another business across the street.
Well, gentlemen, appreciate your time and coming here, and we'll leave that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Rhetorical questions. Charlie Weaver.
We have a concrete company.
Please introduce your chair.
Charlie Weaver. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Business Partnership. We are made up of about 110 CEOs from Minnesota's biggest companies. We employ about 2 million people worldwide and about 450,000 people in Minnesota. We pay over $1 billion in taxes, state and local taxes in Minnesota, and about $15 billion in wages, and contribute about $300 million in charitable giving every year here in Minnesota. So that's just a quick summary of the companies that I represent. Today, I'm not going to give you the details you've heard, and you're going to hear from some more folks about specific proposals, legislative proposals, or specific initiatives. What I'd like to do is just talk briefly about two trends that I just think your committee, more than any other committee, should be aware of as it affects competitiveness here in Minnesota. And Mr. Chair and committee members, before I talk about the two trends, I want to thank you for having this hearing at all. Because, frankly, whether you want to spend more money on education or the environment or transportation or health care or jobs, the bottom line is, in order to have that money, you've got to grow jobs. So investing in Minnesota, growing jobs, is a good thing to be talking about. Because if we grow jobs, you're going to grow revenues that you can invest in whatever the legislature deems necessary. Let me talk just about two things, Mr. Chair. The first is demographics. If you look at trends globally, you heard initially from Mr. Hickey about globalization, demographics is a significant influence on our ability ultimately to attract jobs to Minnesota. And let me tell you why. In essence, our economy in Minnesota and across the country is changing from an economy based on more people producing and less people consuming to more people consuming and fewer people producing. The baby boomers, as you probably read about recently, are just now starting to retire. And there are really three implications of those retirements. Number one, labor shortages. By 2020 in this country, the shortages could be 10 million workers across the United States. In Minnesota, our workforce is going to shrink in comparison to the total workforce 25% in the next 25 years. So that's an impact, number one, of the changing baby boomers, is a shortage of workforce. Number two, weaker tax base. And there's really three reasons we're going to have a less robust tax base going forward than we have now. Number one, income taxes are going to flatten out. Retirees have less taxable income than the people who've kind of built the economy over the last 30 years, so they have less income tax. Secondly, sales taxes are going to lag. Retirees buy non-taxable goods. They spend more time at Walgreens than they do at Target. Prescriptions are non-taxable. Stuff they're buying now is taxable. They just don't buy as much. So sales tax revenues are going to go down. Property tax revenues will go down too. As the baby boomers kind of move out of those big houses in the suburbs, they're going to try to sell to a smaller pool of buyers. That means the value of those homes is probably going to go down. So the rate, if the rate stays the same, you're going to probably get less from your property taxes for those homes going into the future. So that's the three areas, kind of the demographics are going to drive less tax base, and that's a significant issue. The third kind of impact of changing demographics is the demand for public spending is going to go up. Right? You've got this huge kind of pig through a python, right, that's just hitting the retirement age now. That big group of baby boomers now is going into the most expensive times of their lives. And there's no time more expensive than when you turn 55, 60, 65 in terms of health care costs. Health care costs, as you heard before today, is the fastest increasing cost. And retirees consume three times as much health care as non-retirees. So that's going to be a significant costs going forward. So those kind of, the impact of demographics in those three areas is significant, and it's going to change the way we do business. And it, really, if you think about it, what does that mean? The fact that you have fewer workers, smaller tax base, bigger costs, it means that what we're spending, the current level of spending in Minnesota, is just not sustainable. We cannot afford, given those demographics, to continue to spend as much as we have. And if we do, we are not going to be competitive. The second challenge, let me just briefly talk about, is globalization. Mr. Hickey referenced that the United States used to lead the world. We were number one in terms of innovation, technology, and talent. And that's just not true anymore. An economist I recently read said, the fact is, we're in an economic war, we're losing, and most Americans don't know it. We're in an economic war, we're losing that war, and most Americans don't know it. And there's a recent report that talked about the kind of what does the United States have to do to be competitive, how are we going to improve. It's called Losing the Competitive Advantage. And it identified a number of issues that the United States has to address. We are simply going to lose our ability to compete in this changing workforce. And I just want to talk about one of those things today, and that is education. Representative Rukavina brought it up earlier, but one of the things that was identified in this report, kind of analyzing U.S. competitiveness, the finding was this. If U.S. workers are to compete in a world economy that's knowledge-based and driven by technology, the American education system must improve substantially. And the bottom line is, the fact is that although Minnesota kids do pretty good against other states, we're the best in the country in SATs, we're the best in the country in ACTs, we're the best in the country in graduation rate, we are not competitive with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is who we're competing with. We're not competing with Iowa. We're not competing with Wisconsin. We're not competing with California or Texas. We're competing with Singapore and India and China, and they're kicking our kids' butts when it comes to education. Let me just give you a few facts. And it's particularly relevant for our best companies. Our fastest growing companies, as you heard before, with medical device. They need technologists. They need computer analysts. They need engineers. And there's a couple of facts that scare you a little bit, Mr. Chair and members. China graduates four times as many engineers as the United States does. Japan...
There's 40 times the people, for God's sake.
But they did, but they didn't used to do that, Representative Rukavina. Before, they had half the number of engineers that the United States did. Japan has half our population to graduate twice as many engineers. South Korea has one-sixth the population of this country and they graduate as many engineers as the United States does. In a 2003 assessment of 15-year-olds in 41 industrialized nations, the United States was 23rd in science and 24th in math. 82% of the U.S. 12th graders are not proficient in science or math. And physics were last. We are dead last in the world in physics in this 2003 survey. That should give us some pause. Bill Gates, you may have seen recently, said, when I compare our high schools with what I see when I'm traveling abroad, I'm terrified. I'm terrified for our workforce of tomorrow. He said U.S. high schools are obsolete. They no longer provide the kind of competitive advantage that we need in order to compete. As I said before, in Minnesota, we're doing great. I mean, as Representative Rukavina said earlier, in Minnesota, our kids are doing great compared to the rest of the country. But if we look beyond our borders, Minnesota 8th graders, and they're the best in the United States, Minnesota 8th graders in math, they're 26th among 41 countries in the most recent international math and science study. That means we're behind Singapore, Korea, Japan, Belgium, the Czech Republic, Netherlands, Slovenia, Bulgaria, we're behind France. I mean, how bad is that? it's really frustrating. So we're losing to France, among all these other countries, in the eighth grade math. Perhaps what's most disturbing, members, is if you look at fourth graders. If you start math and science fourth graders, we do compete. We're in the top three in the world. When you go to eighth grade, we slip to 12th. And then when you get to 12th grade, we're down to 26th. So something's happening between fourth grade and 12th grade, and we simply are not emphasizing math and science, and we're losing out as a result of that. So it's a significant challenge. And, of course, the other big challenge that you all are familiar with, members, is the although Minnesota is very competitive across the country in eighth grade math, we have the second biggest achievement gap in the nation. That is the gap between white kids who score well and black kids. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, it is criminal. It is criminal what we're doing to our kids of color in our core cities. Less than half of them graduate. Only 5% of black kids who go to Minneapolis or St. Paul ultimately get a four-year degree by the time they're 26 years old. 5%. I mean, it's outrageous. And Minnesota is one of the biggest gaps in the country. So we need to get a handle on these issues, and we've got to get a handle on them pretty quick. Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, let me just summarize by saying that we've got a lot going for us as a state. As the governor and others like to say, we've got a lot of things going for us in terms of health care and employment and high insured and high education state. But I think from our perspective, from the CEO perspective, is my guys get up every day and compete across the globe. And they've got a five-year vision that they look out. And their fear is that the number one concern they have, besides health care as a cost, is a quality workforce. Do we have the kids who show up to our workplaces every day who can compete across the world? And the scariest thing I heard from one of our CEOs, Janet Dolan, former CEO of Tenet, said it used to be we would go to India or China because they had the cheapest labor in the world. They were the cheapest. So whatever you were buying, they were the cheapest. Now companies are going to India, China, Singapore, Ireland, because they're the best. Because they're more qualified. Because they're better. And that should scare us. What should scare us here in Minnesota is we contemplate how to keep our, especially our large companies here, who can move in the blink of an eye, Mr. Chair. It's no longer true that our companies are anchored to Minnesota. Companies in this new global economy can move in the course of a week. There's no reason to be in Minnesota other than some amenities we have. So we need to really be smart and nimble, and the work this committee is doing to look at this is really important, because our companies want to stay here, but they also need to compete.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I know you have to go. Do you have time for a quick...
Always time for Representative Vitorino.
And last night I had the opportunity to run into former Representative Weaver, and it was a lot of fun, and I actually left when he was up to speak because I didn't want to have to beat him up. He's such a nice guy. But then he didn't come on when he was supposed to. You moved him down in the agenda.
Go.
I'm glad you're back.
But, Mr. Chair, my question to Charlie is this. You brought up what we should be doing in this state to compete for the businesses you represent, and what is their proposal? Because I believe I'm not mistaken when I say that last year, although we did give an increase finally to K-12 education spending, the year before we actually cut it for the first time in history, and the 2 years before that it was flat funding. And I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Blazer. Your companies need to compete, and how are they proposing that we educate more engineers, etc., and help those minority students, etc.?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rivovina, first I would point out that there hasn't been a study in the history of the world that's linked what you pay with what you get in education. Never. There's no indication that by spending more you get a better result. In fact, in a lot of small towns, small school districts in Minnesota, we spend far less and have similar challenges in terms of minority kids or immigrant kids. They do very well with less money. So, number one, I'd question, I don't think more money means better results. But I think our view is you spend smarter. So that means set clear standards, measure the standards, report the standards, and then give parents a choice. Those are our principles in terms of education. And we've made great progress in Minnesota. Now, for the first time, parents can compare schools. That's a good thing. We have charter schools that provide new opportunities for kids. So there are some charter schools in Minneapolis, Mr. Chair, Representative Rivovina, who have the exact same kids. Kids who are poor, kids who don't have dads, kids who have grown up in awful situations, and they go to a charter school where there's discipline and expectation and rigorous performance-based criteria, and they do very well. And the same kids go a block away to a public school without those factors, and they do very poorly.
Well, Mr. Chair,
and I don't know, I'm no expert on, I haven't been on the Education Committee in years, Mr. Chair, and Representative Weaver, but I do know that, you know, that charter schools and parochial schools and that don't have to take the same kids either, that some of these other students that are harder to educate for whatever reason, that public schools have to take. Now, I think our public schools do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem is, you know, sharing the wealth and a little bit, and your father was a great supporter of sharing the wealth. Your father brought us fiscal disparities in the metro area.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good moderate Republican. The old true moderate Republican who believed that, you know, money could equalize things. We've gotten away from that in this state. I would say there are a lot of small districts that do a better job spending less money because they might not have the same problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they still have two parents at home, actually. You know, those other reasons that come in there. But I, not to anything you try, I'll tell you what. You know, we produce, I come from an area that relies on still on raw resources. We create that wealth from the ground. You know, nobody creates wealth, but you're right. The guy that was here earlier on is right about business people create wealth. And we do that up north, and we do it more competitively than any place else in the country. Per man hour, we are the most creative, productive people there are in the iron ore industry. But we can't keep competing if iron ores keep cutting wages. Now, I'm proud to say, Mr. Chair, that I went through a whole Christmas without purchasing one thing made in China. You know? Because I know that 10% of everything we buy goes to the Chinese army. Now, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, and I've admitted that publicly in the legislature. I said I'm the dumbest guy in the state of Minnesota. But I can't figure out why we're scared to hell of 8 million Cuban communists, but not 1.3 billion Chinese communists. This boggles my mind. So I am not giving them 10% of everything I buy. I'm having a hard time finding underwear. Because I try to get everything made in USA. If you look hard enough, you can find these things. And it boggles my mind that we are supposedly at war with Pakistan, or not at Pakistan, they're supporting us, but somebody's Indonesia, and you can't go to the store, and that's all you find. You know, it's an unfair, uncompetitive global market that your people are competing in, and I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to compete, and most of it has to do with wages and environmental standards that aren't met in other places. But I just want the committee and you to know that I'm spending all my money on your major companies. I don't buy anything made outside this country, and I'm having trouble. My clothes are falling apart, but I'm still finding things made in the
U.S. Mr. Weaver, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And members, there's a few members that have more questions. Maybe you can ask them offline because we do have some other people, but out of respect for them, they have schedules to keep to. We got to get to. Thank you, Mr. Weaver. Tom Day.
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to listen to statements, we have the right to say that they're not correct.
Please take your message, Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Day. I work for the Minnesota Restaurant Association, Minnesota Hotel and Lodging Association, and the Minnesota Resort and Campground Associations. All together, we represent roughly 3,000 hospitality and tourism businesses throughout the state. I'm also now able to announce exciting news regarding the state's lodging industry. Effective April 1, our Hotel and Lodging Association is forming a new group and merging with the Minnesota Association of Innkeepers, the old Motel Association, to form one statewide lodging association, the Minnesota Lodging Association. I could echo much of what Mr. Blazer said and some of the others have said in regards to big business costs and the impact that a lot of regular generic issues have. Healthcare costs are a huge impact on us. Workers' comp, taxes and fees. But I wanted to come to you today with issues specific to the hospitality and tourism industry. The biggest and most glaring of all hospitality business issues is the lack of a tip credit, and it comes as no surprise that I would bring that up today. We are one of only seven states in the nation that doesn't recognize tips as wages. The federal government and 43 other states currently allow for a server wage. This puts our restaurants at a significant competitive disadvantage to restaurant businesses in other states. Some of the other restaurant issues specifically, smoking bans, the growing changes in local smoking bans, the discrepancies between bars and restaurants, and the blame of smoking in a restaurant being placed on the restaurant operator rather than the individual smoking is becoming more and more of an issue. Our associations have traditionally believed that individual business owners, not the government, should make the decision on whether or not to permit smoking in these establishments. Obesity lawsuits, we're seeing a growing epidemic nationally. We have supported language. It is passed in 21 other states. We'd like to see some sort of language passed here that places the blame of obesity more on the individual rather than on the food and on the restaurant that is serving it. Dram shop is another huge issue that we're dealing with. It's a growing problem with liquor service businesses. We're seeing mass lawsuits coming forward. If a restaurant serves a beer to an individual during lunch, that individual goes home, drinks a case of beer at home on their own, and causes an accident that evening, the restaurants are being blamed for that lawsuit, or are being blamed for that accident. We believe that those lawsuits are getting far out of control. Switching over to one of my other hats, the hotel, motel, and lodging industry. One of the big issues that we're dealing with there is small from a fiscal point of view at the state, but it is something that's impacting the hotels and motels throughout the state, and that's the state fire marshal fees. When the state fire marshal's office was created in the early 1900s, a tax on insurance premiums was also created called the state fire marshal's tax, which was dedicated solely towards the state fire marshal's office. Unfortunately, in 81, the fund was undedicated, and all the money collected from that is going to the general fund. Last glance, there was $7 million being raised from that tax. However, due to the budget constraints 3 years ago, a decision was made to eliminate funding for the fire marshal inspection program, a cut of $750,000 annually, pales in comparison to $7 million being raised. Fees were placed on the lodging industry for these fire marshal inspections, even though we're already paying the taxes for them in addition. The fee is a triennial fee of $435 per property and an additional $7 to $8 per room. The smallest motel properties are paying around $700. The largest, and I've heard from two of them that were inspected within the last 2 months, are paying $7,000 to the state for a two-hour inspection. Local lodging taxes, we're concerned about the growing focus being placed on a tax on local lodging taxes. We have a growing concern over the requests of communities to use lodging taxes for their own general fund purposes rather than for marketing purposes, which is the intent of the lodging tax law. There's also a concern with the Department of Revenue. The state is charged with collecting lodging taxes in three communities in the state out of the 36 that have lodging taxes. As a result of the Department of Revenue collecting these lodging taxes, they've recently announced that lodging taxes must now be collected on movie rentals, phone charges, room service, and even dry cleaning if it's purchased at a hotel. We feel that that's grossly wrong and that a lodging tax is just that, a tax on lodging. For resorts and campgrounds, resorts and campgrounds are an essential part of the history and culture of our state. In 1970, the state boasted almost 3,000 resorts statewide. By the summer of 2006, this summer, estimates show that we will be under 900 resorts in the state. It's alarming. Lakeshore values are rising at such a dramatic rate that Minnesota's resorts are being squeezed. Once resort land is sold and developed, the economic vitality that resort brought to a community is lost. This is a growing epidemic with no clear solution. There are a number of resort and campground preservation pieces that we've supported as legislation in the past, changes in limited market value, sales tax exemptions for the expansions of resorts, tourism loan program. We think this is an easy one that could easily be brought back. There used to be a $2 million revolving loan program. that resorts and small lodging properties were able to take advantage of if they wanted to add a cabin or add a couple rooms to a property. There was a loan program available. We are proposing bringing that back, and we'll be introducing legislation on that. Shoreline management is another one that's emerged as the top local issue with resort and campgrounds as far as the changes that are being made in shoreline management and the inability of resorts also to be able to expand to meet the needs of their guests. Going across the board for all hospitality and tourism businesses, I think there's one more out there in addition to a number of issues, and that's low tourism funding. Minnesota's annual investment in tourism has been steadily decreasing from a height of just over $10 million 4 years ago to approximately $7.7 million today. Minnesota's domestic advertising budget ranks 26th in the nation. It's significantly smaller than that of our closest competitors such as Illinois, Missouri, Wisconsin, even South Dakota. Even the city of Chicago outspends the state of Minnesota in marketing money. With that, there are a number of other issues, stadium issues, eminent domain, local fees, energy costs, immigration issues, private cabin rentals. There's a broad list that affects us, but with that, I'll just stand for questions.
Questions for Mr. Day, Representative Moyer.
Well, we're just trying to figure it out here. It looks like somewhere around 10 to 20 cents that a meal would be incurred additional for if you had tip credit, and the fact you don't have tip credit, I don't think a lot of Minneapolis residents are going to drive to Milwaukee or something for 20 cents a meal.
Mr. Dick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulley, fortunately, restaurant and hospitality and tourism is not an exportable commodity, so Representative Rukavina can be purchasing meals and lodging in the state and be comfortable with it. The reason I brought that up is it points out a competitive disadvantage that we do have with 43 other states, that they all have tip credit. All of those states are able to pay wages well below the minimum wage, which puts us at a competitive disadvantage to them.
How do we... I guess I just don't understand how we compete that way. It only 20 cents difference per meal, and you're not going to move. I mean, people in Minneapolis are not going to move someplace else. So you're competing against other people that are in the same situation, basically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulley, the concern is restaurants moving to other communities. The restaurant industry is growing at a much slower rate in the state of Minnesota than it is other places in the nation. Corporate restaurant chains are some are able to come into the state and find niche markets and are able to survive. They're able to supplement their costs and their lack of a higher revenue in the state with restaurants in other states. But unfortunately, there are very few independent restaurants that are opening in the state anymore. It's much more cost effective if I were to invest in a restaurant and decide to open one up. It would be much more cost effective for me to look to open that in other states rather than Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dick.
Thank you for your time.
Michael Moonen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Moonen. I am the division president of Toll Brothers, which is an Eagan-based builder. We're a national company that operates in 20 states. I'm speaking to you here today not only as a builder, but as a representative of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, the Builders Association of Minnesota, and the National Association of Home Builders. Collectively, our members number in the 225,000 range and build roughly 2 million housing units a year across the United States. I'd like to thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm going to come at it from a different tack. I'm going to speak quite positively about the environment which we as builders face across the nation, but also specifically in Minnesota. Recent projections provided by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have indicated that over the next 20 years, there's going to be a need for over 20 million new housing units in the United States. And within the Twin Cities, the Metropolitan Council have projected that by 2030, the population of this region is going to increase by a million new people, which provides for housing needs of 550,000 housing units. So the challenge is quite formidable for our members and for my company alike to provide that much needed housing. I think our housing building, our members have done a formidable job in terms of providing housing for the residents of Minnesota over the past number of years. Routinely, we build roughly 40,000 housing units in the state of Minnesota annually. And in the Twin Cities, we have averaged somewhere between 15 and 25,000 housing units over the last 8 or 9 years. There has been considerable talk about the slowdown in the housing market, but I'd like to say that it's more likely a return to more sustainable levels, that we're coming back into historical averages, averages which bear out the economic development and the needs of the communities in the state of Minnesota as well as within the metropolitan area. Housing has been a poster child for economic growth for the last 10 years. And because of that, demand has been high and housing prices have appreciated in the same step. Statistics today indicate that the average price for a house throughout greater Minnesota is $225,000. And within the Twin Cities area, it's slightly higher than that. I think with the moderation in the housing demand today, we're going to see a softening of the escalation housing prices and a return to more normal conditions. However, it is an issue that is greatly concerned to our members in terms of fulfilling our role to provide the housing for future workers within the metropolitan area and with the state at large. What we're seeing is a number of trends which are coming on the horizon which are impacting our industry and changing the face of our industry. First of all, we're seeing the moderation in the number of building permits. And what that means is we've had to be more judicious in terms of how we look at land, how we look at business opportunities. We're seeing a changing face in the type of housing that's being built. What we're seeing is a greater number of attached houses or multifamily houses, largely to address the affordable issue, but also to reflect the changing tastes and preferences of today's consumer. And thirdly, we're seeing a greater diversity in the number of in the types of housing and forms of housing. The days where the single-family home was king is coming to a change, and we're seeing greater variety in terms of mid-rise buildings. Just outside of this building along the banks of the Mississippi, you see a great project that provides an indication of that, and that is the housing that's being done on the old Harvest States and the old Kaufman metal fabrication plant area. And it's an indication of what's happening. Minnesota will always remain an attractive place for economic growth. And we've heard from a number of the testifiers before that Minnesota is attractive for businesses moving in. And we are in partnership with those to provide the housing necessary to provide the accommodation for those workers that are coming in. Representative Mulley said that there were all sorts of reasons why Minnesota was such an attractive place. Number one, in terms of education. Number six, in terms of average house family income. These are all reasons why people search out to move to Minnesota and bring their jobs to Minnesota. However, in order for us to fulfill our role in providing housing for the residents, the future residents of Minnesota, there are a number of challenges that we need to face. In terms of accommodating a growing population, we need to work with the strategies that are in play both at the state and at the local level to accommodate that growth, to find the places that will allow us to build the houses that are demanded by the future consumer, and also to do so on a timely basis in light of the infrastructure opportunities that are presented them by the municipalities. We have to be ever vigilant that there is enough infrastructure in place so that we are able to immediately respond to the market and therefore be able to build the houses that are most affordable at any given point in time. Housing affordability remains a concern for many of our members. Housing simply costs too much. And it's not the point of pointing the fingers at any one individual or any one group and say it's all your fault, but rather the issue has to be shared by all players in the field. we all can do a better job in terms of attempting to make housing more affordable across the entire board and not simply affordable to one particular segment of the population. Regulation plays a very, very important role in terms of the cost of housing. We need to establish a common sense approach with respect to the regulation that we're imposing. Restrictive zoning, environmental policies that bear no reality to best management practices, restrictions which attempt to manipulate the market, and the establishment of rules of the game which are anything but clear and concise, all add considerable cost and uncertainty to those of us that are attempting to build a housing in a variety of communities and doing so with predictability and certainty with respect to our cost environment. Regulation does have an immediate cost to the cost of housing, but it is not a cost that we as builders absorb, but it's rather one that gets passed on to the consumer in terms of how our housing prices. The market itself is a great barometer of how we have to respond to the needs of the consumer. It's ever-changing, and we need to work in partnership with decision-makers to ensure that we have the nimbleness to move, to adapt to the market forces as they change. In Minnesota, we probably have the best building code going insofar as providing for regulation to allow us to build houses which are the very best that have been built. There may be some disagreement with respect to that comment, but I truly believe that the code provides us the opportunity. However, we have to be mindful that changes to the code do not bring about unintended consequences with respect to making the houses too tight or creating a situation which precipitates unhealthy housing situations with poor indoor air quality, etc. We also have to face the fact that in many cases there are competing public policy goals which work in different directions. Affordability versus zoning aesthetics. Growing in versus growing out. Economic development versus open space and agricultural land preservation. Compact urban growth versus community preservation. Support of redevelopment and infill versus the preservation of property rights. As we look forward, our industry is looking quite optimistically with respect to working hand-in-hand with our decision-making partners to ensure that policies provide for a fair and reasonable regulatory environment to ensure durable and affordable housing for tomorrow's generation of citizens. We will look forward to working toward advancing regulation which enhances the relationships between the builders and the consumers. And we will use a wide variety of housing choice, development, and redevelopment options to address the market demands over the next 20 years. And I thank you very much for your comment, your attention.
Thank you very much. Is there questions from members? Representative Mahler? No? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mike Hickey.
We have to listen to Mike Hickey again?
Yes.
What, did you walk out and change clothes?
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard you've already heard from Mike Hickey.
That's right. He said he's always standard high, too, so don't blow it.
But despite that, I'm going to go forward. Thanks for the chance to be here today, and really appreciate the fact for all your concern on this issue and holding a hearing and devoting the time to this important topic. I did do a little survey, actually, in preparation for today's hearing to possibly try to bring something new to the table. And NFIB and, I should say, I'm Mike Hickey, the National Federation of Independent Business, but it's the nation's largest business group with 16,000 members in Minnesota, 600,000 members nationwide, and a significant member base in every district. Our Washington office is renowned for doing something called the Small Business Problems and Priorities Survey, and I tried to kind of on the cheap and very quickly do something for today's hearing that's clearly not as thorough as them, and the results of this will not surprise you one bit, especially the top problem for small business at the moment. 70% of our survey that we just got back said health costs of health insurance, trying to provide affordable health insurance is the number one problem. The top four were workers' comp costs at 11%, state individual income tax burdens at 7%, and the estate or death tax at 4%. That is the estate or death tax is our number one fiscal priority for this year, trying to at least conform to the federal threshold exemptions. And right now they're about $1 million apart, and we are going to have more and more people who are stuck paying the Minnesota estate tax and not the federal. And I realize it might be a hard sell in light of the recent case and the huge amount of money it brought in, so they've got to do some estate planning. But overall, it's going to cost about $14 million to conform to meeting the federal exemption threshold of $2 million. So estates under that would be exempt. So that's our number one fiscal priority. It's especially big for family-held businesses and family-held farms. But back to the health insurance issue, Mr. Chairman, what we need to do is to get your new law implemented that you and others worked so hard to pass. Get some strong bipartisan support for that this year. You working closely with Senator Scheid and many members of this committee helped, and we need to get this law desperately implemented. And so far, no insurers step forward, and it's very frustrating. And I don't know if another day in this committee we actually need a bill to force insurers to provide that critical plan that you worked so hard to pass. Hopefully it doesn't get down to that, but so far nobody in this market has stepped forward to offer small employers a badly needed policy that could reduce their costs close to 20%. The whole HSA issue is helping tremendously. A lot of people are going to HSAs. Conforming to the tax deductibility was important too, but we really need to implement the flexible small employer flexible benefit plans, and so that is that remains the number one problem in this survey, and probably any survey anybody's done regarding problems and priorities for small business or maybe just business in general. Aside from our survey and just the results we had on that, I do want to comment on some of our long-standing issues. They are long-standing, but they're important. And they'll remain important to this committee and to this legislature and anybody who cares about business issues. But the first one is just the high rate of taxation in Minnesota. We remain number four in total taxes according to the Census Bureau. And we just can't seem to budge off of that. We bounce back and forth between three or four. But it's certainly, you would hope, would convince people that there's no value in us going to three, two, or one, as we've seen some of the large tax increase proposals that were proposed in the Senate over the last several years. But it's just not going to help this state to get a stigma of being that high tax when we're already fourth. In other surveys by the Census Bureau, we've been three. We kind of bounce back and forth. On the individual income tax, we're also very high on that. According to the Tax Foundation, we're third highest in average burden on the individual income tax, although our top rate is ninth highest. So we made some progress back in 1999 when we had the largest tax cut in the history of the state. At least the top rate at 7.85% is ninth highest, not first highest, not second highest. But again, proposals to raise that and make that the second or third or highest are really a mistake. And hopefully we can steer clear of that. In the area of commercial property taxes, we've made some progress on that with our 01 reform, a big reform of the property tax system. We dropped out of top categories in a lot of areas. We went from 5th to 11th for urban property valued at $1 million, and from 3rd to 7th on average for commercial property valued at $1 million. So we did make some progress there, although NIOP puts together a great analysis, and this is the one from last year using 04 data showing us just very uncompetitive with our neighboring states. On a manufacturing sample manufacturing plant of 70,000 square feet, 99 employees, we had an average tax of $110,000. North Dakota, a fraction of it, at $25,000. Wisconsin, $63,000 on average for that same plot of land and property. Iowa, $70,000. And a little bit surprising, South Dakota, not that far ahead of us at $97,000. So I don't know if the Dan Scott commercials totally ring true, but they're not that much of an advantage on commercial property, at least in the context of that analysis in South Dakota versus here. But we've made some progress there, but still remain very high and not very competitive with our neighboring states. In the area of workers' comp, an issue that many of us have worked on forever around here, we really have made some progress. An analysis I just found showed us 21st most expensive, just about the national average. It was put together by the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, and that's not a bad result for Minnesota on some of these labor-oriented, workforce-oriented costs. For us to be above the national average, I think is pretty good. It shows we really had significant progress from all our hard work on the 95 law and the 92 law, although health care costs continue to rapidly escalate in workers' comp, and it's a real concern. And we've got to get a handle on health care costs. You could probably say that for any state. But that is the one area in the workers' comp area that remains very concerning. And finally, on unemployment insurance, upon an analysis by the Federal Department of Labor, that showed our tax burden is just about at the national average. So that was encouraging, too. And those are some of the issues that we've traditionally kept an eye on around this committee and around the legislature. And I appreciate the time to be here today and to make some comments about what matters to small business.
Okay, questions, Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hickey, you didn't mention capital gains tax. What's your organization's thought on that for here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Hickey.
Oh, we'd be for cutting it, Representative Paul. It's in the context of what's possible this year.
Just to interrupt,
it's a concern to some of our members, no doubt.
That certainly was a softball, I threw you.
Other questions? Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Mr. Hickey, you brought up the state tax and family-held farms. Are you taking the position that people have to give up their family farms because of the estate tax?
Am I taking the position? No, I'm not taking the position. I'm telling you it's a problem. Dealing with the estate tax is a problem for a family-held farm. That's what I'm telling you. And we're out of sync with the federal government on the exemption threshold. Oh. Matter of fact, we're out of sync, Representative Mullery, by $1 million. So our states with about $2 million is not going to pay the federal, but at $1 million they're going to pay the state. So we have payers in Minnesota that have to pay the state and not pay the federal, and that's not a good position for us to be in.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hickey, I'm very aware of the estate tax, and I was trying to find out if you're one of the ones, because I hear people saying that people have to sell their family farms because of the estate tax, and so I checked with the IRS and they haven't found a single instance of that anywhere, so just want to make sure you weren't taking that position.
Well, I don't know if that's how often that is happening, Representative Mulry, but I know people are spending a lot of money on life insurance and all kinds of other insurance and other legal mechanisms to try to hang on to these family-held businesses and farms. If we could at least conform to the threshold, it would help.
Thank you. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, you talked about the fact that the insurance industry hasn't gotten into the small business flexible benefit plans yet. Have you talked to the insurance industry to find out why they're not interested in that? Because I know we tried that once before and no insurance companies came forward at that point either, or something similar to that. I don't know that it was exactly the same. But why aren't they jumping on the bandwagon?
Representative Goodwin, actually, I might be able to answer that better. I've talked to several of them, and there's different ones, companies out there that are working on products right now.
And what are those companies?
I don't have permission to say. I think it's a competitive thing for them, and it wouldn't be fair for me to start saying companies. But there are ones that are for me to start saying companies. But there are ones that are working on it, and frankly, they're going to be all over the board as far as what the benefits are. I don't think you're going to necessarily see a plan that has none of the mandates. You'll probably see something in between the full mandate plan and the totally stripped down plan.
I'm anxiously awaiting.
So am I, believe me, and I know Mr. Hickey is. Thank you very much.
Chairman, I just want to add, Representative Goodwin, I appreciate your concern on that. I'm not sure we really tried this before, though. We had something I think we passed way back with the original Minnesota Care Law that didn't give the same amount of product flexibility. I'm not sure what you're referring to. We had an aborted attempt in 1999 that I think Representative Wilkins tried to help us out on, but we had something way back in the early 90s in the Minnesota Care Law, but it wasn't as flexible. It didn't as appealing to employers, so I'm not sure if we really ever tried it.
No, it wasn't exactly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It wasn't exactly that. It was more of a small business pooling plan or something like that. Wasn't it close to that? And we had it on the books for 3 years or some were around there before we then changed it to this, but during the time we had it, no insurance company has ever sold the product.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hickey. Glenn Dorfman.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Glenn Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And I want to start out by saying that unlike the builder's representative, I am a little less optimistic. I'm not here to complain about anything. I just want to update you on what's going on in the state in terms of housing. We've had a great run. Housing has had a great run. And Minnesota's housing is... we're 26th most affordable out of 50 markets, 50 of the largest markets in the United States. So we are not unaffordable by any stretch of the imagination. We have problems with some folks who need certainly some sort of cash rent voucher or subsidy so they can afford better units. Representative Clark and I go back a long time on this. That's a simple deal for us, but we won't do it, meaning just give poor people some dough. And they will then be able to afford a lot of rental housing, which is vacant now. And let me just add to what I said earlier. The home ownership rate in Minnesota in the last 7 years has gone from 68% to 78%. Second highest in the United States, which is, it's always been right around second highest in the United States, next to West Virginia. When I first saw that, it was troubling because I 3 years I've listened to legislators on the tax committee tell me it is because we have low taxes, which I knew wasn't true, but it was interesting and it made for good rhetoric. So I actually looked into why certain states have high rates of home ownership and certain states do not. The states that have high rates of home ownership are states that never started out with a lot of rental units. So states like California, New York, Massachusetts, Illinois will never have high rates of home ownership because they have an enormous number of rental units. Minnesota was settled by, and I just finished the history of Minnesota this summer, was settled by, as all of you know, Norwegian principally and Germans, all of whom came from places that home ownership was a very high value. So the reason that Minnesota has a high rate of home ownership is we never built very much rental housing. We still have very little rental housing compared to other metropolitan regions and state regions of our size. And the reason is we people value home ownership. So I want to once again register this point. In this last cycle, as a result of monetary policy, meaning the Federal Reserve's keeping interest rates low for a long time, not because of taxes, not because of brilliant real estate sales, not because of great real estate lawyers, but because interest rates were low, we sold everyone who could possibly afford a house, and also because of some fabulous federal government loan programs, we sold everyone in Minnesota who could possibly cash flow a house. And that's one of the reasons we're seeing a fairly substantial rental vacancy rate. Because lots of renters who are just as smart as homeowners did the cash flow analysis and said, it's cheaper for me to rent now, to own, than it is to rent. And we'll have all of these numbers for you by session on how many of the 10% increase were renters, but of the nationally, of the increase, 7% are renters and or immigrants. So I want to get to that next. But I wanted to first give you a little background on the membership because we've done some work. Our membership has gone from 12,500 to 25,000 in 7 years. There are not high barriers to entry to get into real estate. According to the Department of Deed, what is the new name? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Is it the Department of Economic
Employment? Economic.
Employment Economic Development. Realtors in, real estate licensees in Minnesota made in 2004 $556 a week. What we did was we broke down our membership by how much they made, and we have 5% of the realtors in the state making over $100,000, 15% making between 45 and 99, 40% making between 25 and 45, and 40% making less than 25. So I would argue that I run the largest anti-poverty program in the private sector. Meaning, if you compare what realtors make to what janitors in the public schools make. They make more as janitors in the public schools on average than the realtors make in the state. So when people said to us last year, well, Glenn, I just don't understand, you know, why you all would not support more taxes, because we've supported over the last 25 years tax increases under Governor Perpich and under Governor Carlson. And the reason is this last piece that I'd like to, we're a little odd ducks, so that's why they hire an odd duck lobbyist. The realtors pay, they're independent contractors, and like insurance agents, they pay both sides of Social Security. They don't have anybody paying that. They pay their own health care, half of them. Half of the, 20% of them have their husbands pay, husbands or wives paying their health care, and the rest don't have health care. About 30% of our members do not have health care coverage. So they pay both sides. They pay, have to pay their own retirement in a SEP or 401k. And in the fourth highest tax state in the country, in the state that has the 49th lowest poverty rate, and I mentioned this to the governor the other day, if we had the courage, he, you, all of us, so I don't, if we had the courage, this is probably the only state in the country that could solve the problem of poverty. We could eradicate poverty in the state. That's how close we are. But it would require us to say to middle-class public employees, sorry, you got to go out and get some of the private sector jobs that are being made available because you're smart, and we'd have to move some of that dough into helping educate folks who are low-income, because that's the only way they're going to get out, and we have to do a better job at that. And by the way, that's well-documented. I just came from New York City this weekend visiting a bunch of Harlem, Bedford-Stuyvesant schools, visiting my son, and it's very clear that the models to teach inner-city kids are available. They're very adaptable, and Harlem has it, Bed-Stuy has it, and these are very difficult children. I mean, Minnesota kids are tough kids, some of them in the inner city. They come from tough homes, but by comparison, these children are in very good shape compared to these inner city kids. And again, we'll provide you with that data also. The last thing I'd like to mention is, that's the reason we took the position we did, because and the Senate actually lived up to my concern. I want to mention this because many of you told me this summer, and I've not visited with many of you, but this summer that you didn't know this, but the Senate position last year, which was raising taxes on the wealthiest people in Minnesota, $250,000 and above, people said, well, Glenn, I just don't understand. You know, that's an easy position. Why not do it? Because we know your membership doesn't make that kind of money. Well, as some of you know about me, I'm not that parochial. But I did an analysis, and most at the high income level in Minnesota, we tax subchapter S corporations at the top tier. That means that six realtors who work together in a company who earn $50,000 each, therefore earn $300,000, would have paid 21% higher taxes under the Senate tax bill. That's not all right with us. That is not all right with us. And very few members knew that. Very, very few. Ann Rest didn't know that. And she's one of my very favorite brainy members. And if she didn't know it, that scared me to death. And I didn't do a good enough job, obviously, disseminating. We sent three emails, and we tried to talk to as many folks as we could. So that was a little scary. And in that regard, in years past, somebody said, well, what tax increase? We need a tax increase. And I want to reiterate again, it would be nice if we could, as some suggested, Governor Perpich, I think, was the first one to suggest it. It would be nice if we could create a priority system in the spending and say these are the seven most important things that we spend money on and put the dough in there, and then we'd have plenty of money for everybody. But it's hard, and I'm sensitive as I'm capable of being, to the plight you guys are in, because it's much easier to raise taxes than it is to redistribute the money, because somebody gets hurt under that arrangement. But if you think about spending the way I do, if you think about it in terms of progressive or regressive, there is no sense, for example, in spending much money subsidizing my father-in-law in a nursing home when he has enough money to take care of himself. And what we do in Minnesota, we're doing better, because Senator Berglund's done a nice job on this, we're alleviating the ability of Minnesotans to give their money away, you know, go down to Florida, live there, give their money away, and then come back here and live on Medicaid, which is a good thing. So the last thing I want to mention is immigration, and this is the reason I need to keep talking with the governor. I come from New York City. And so I didn't grow up on a farm. And I have never gotten Minnesota's social attitudes. I don't understand this anti-gay stuff. I don't get any of it. I just don't get it. I don't get any of it. But that's me. I've lived here a long time, and there's lots of rednecks I've figured out and people read. No. This is. I don't. I'm not being. I'm respectful of the diversity of opinions on these issues. But as a person who grew up amongst gay people and was never molested by them, it is beyond my comprehension the kinds of things people say. Having said that, and I'm not arguing for this, I want you to understand, the immigration issue is this. In housing specifically, if we did not have illegal immigrants roofing our houses, Hispanics, if we did not have illegal immigrants picking our beets and the farms, if we did not have illegal immigrants laying brick, because the Italians are out of bricklaying, the Mexicans are laying brick, and they're very good at it. If we did not have them, housing costs would be 25% higher than they are today. Now, that's a problem for all of us, because our constituents don't get all that. And by the way, inner-city constituents are just as troubling to me on immigration as suburban and greater Minnesota constituents. Minnesota is an odd place, considering all of us came from someplace else. And then we, of course, pushed the Native Americans out because we wanted them out, we wanted to be in. But I won't get into that either. So that's my progressive nature. Now let me be a little more conservative and end. The Met Council number of 1 million residents, or 1 million new households, that's an interesting number. The Met Council is rarely right. I've tracked them for 25 years. The only way that Minnesota is going to be able to compete is if we start looking at our both our regulation and our taxes, because I don't read very many papers anymore, but my son has me reading the Financial Times of London. And the reason is you get an international perspective rather than a New York Times perspective or this trash that we call a paper in Minneapolis. But here you at least get an international perspective. You have other countries' writers talking. And in the paper yesterday, this is the headline: prospect of housing downturn casts pall over U.S. economy. So I want to finish with this, if I could, Mr. Chairman. The reason that we're against raising taxes in the fourth highest tax state, and the reason we have to figure out a way, in a bipartisan way, because you can't do it otherwise, to reallocate money to people who need it, cut the rest of us off the dole. So I'm against LGA. I'm for rebates to poor homeowners. So if you want to provide relief to homeowners who are poor, we're with you. Give them a rebate like Governor Carlson did. But do not tell me, after all these years of studying, and that LGA equals property tax relief. When you give money to government, that is not tax relief for homeowners. That's money for government. So you'll hear more about that. And interestingly, I think that's right. The last thing is the homeownership issue. In the United States, but in particular Minnesota, we've had a 70% run in house values. The European Union and the Scandinavian states and Germany had an increase of in the hundreds of 20% range. Those housing markets are now deflating. In the United States, consumers drive 70%, 75% of the economy through spending, buying things. I don't agree with Representative Rick Avina on much anyway, but when he said he didn't buy anything made in China for Christmas, I'm reminded of two things. Number one, I thought all of us were interested in making people who are poor less poor. That means not just Americans or Minnesotans, it ought to mean everyone in the world. And if we make the rest of the world richer, they'll buy more stuff that we produce, which will give our workers better paying jobs. The biotechnology industry in Minnesota is now competing, the Mayo and University of Minnesota coalition is now competing with California. We put a couple hundred million dollars in, they put a billion in the first round. Highway 128 at Harvard and Boston, they put $1.6 billion in the first round. So that's who we're competing with, and we're worried about property tax relief on a bunch of homeowners, most of whom can pay their property tax bill without question. The ones who can't, we should help. It won't cost us much to do that. So what I'm worried about is as housing slows, as it is doing now in the States, and commercial industrial, by the way, is going up in value, which means that in the inner city there's going to be a huge shift from houses to commercial, which means house value, house taxes will start to moderate, and commercial values and taxes will start to rise. So there's no need for anybody to adjust anything. And by the way, we mentioned this to you some years ago, and you didn't listen, and we were right about that, and we'll be right about this again. Because we don't know a lot about a lot of things, but we do know a lot about housing values and property values. So the thing that I'm worried about is as housing values go back to historical levels, which in Minnesota for the last 50 years is 3%, house values have gone up for 60 years about 3% on average. In the last 5 or 8 years, they've gone up about 10 or 12%, depending upon where the property is located. Some have gone up 20%, Lakeshore. That amount of money has provided a stimulus for people to spend. And this is the last point I make. I'm sorry, I keep saying this.
Promises, promise.
The last point, I know I do promise, and I'm sorry, I really appreciate the committee's indulgence. Homes, we used to hear things in the legislature when I first started, like people can be taxed out of homes. That isn't possible anymore. Here's why. If I have a job, here's why. Because homes used to be illiquid, and today they're liquid. Today, my father-in-law took his home. He went out at 86. He was a state employee, retired state employee. He went out at 86, took a reverse equity loan, had the house he bought for $100,000, give him an annuity. At the end of the day, once the house is, you know, all that value goes back to him, and by the way, it's indexed for inflation, so if the house value goes up, he gets more money, you know, or gets to have the money over a long period of time. So we couldn't do that years ago. That's new. You couldn't borrow against your house years ago. 15 years ago, you could not borrow against your house. Now you can take a home equity line of credit and pay your Dayton's shopping bill off, which, of course, we've tried to change nationally because we don't want people to borrow on an appreciating asset to pay off depreciating assets. So what we're worried about is, and by the way, you can take a home equity loan, home equity line of credit, for all sorts of things. So homes are no longer illiquid. This is a very powerful issue, which nobody's paying attention to. And not you, but I can't get anybody to pay attention. I can't even get the banks to pay attention to it, and they should understand this. So we're not going to have to worry as much about seniors as we used to because Medicare has helped them and home values for many of them have increased enormously and most seniors are in good shape. We've got about 6% of Minnesota seniors that are living in poverty. But we do have a lot of children and young people who are going to have a hard time affording a home unless we create more high-quality jobs. And if you look at the transference between Wisconsin and Minnesota, Wisconsin continues to send Minnesota very educated folks, and Minnesota continues to send Wisconsin blue-collar jobs. That's a hard thing for a lot of us to cope with because we know that in blue-collar jobs, folks with not a lot of education can make a decent living. But that's not the direction Minnesota's going. Minnesota's going in the direction of if you're smart, you get a lot of money, and you work in Minnesota. If you're not too smart, or if you, I shouldn't say that's not fair, if you've worked in the Ford plant and you've been a tremendous worker and you're diligent because of international competition, because, you know, car making is not going down in value. The car makers, we sold more cars in 2005 than we sold any year previously. It's just that they're Japanese cars. So, in conclusion, and we'll send you this, please be sensitive to the fact that homes are liquid, they're not illiquid, that home values can be used, and if home values begin to fall or we tax them or regulate them into a problem, we're going to lose retail sales and we're going to throw this economy into a recession. The national economy looks like it's entering recession now. Minnesota's state enters recessions a year later than the nation's economy. So in 2007, sometime, we're going to have a problem. And the only reason I came today wasn't to talk about how you need to do. I just want you to, on a bipartisan basis, if you can, understand that we are facing great prosperity because we're a very wealthy state, and we have some problems that we could fix if we had the will to do it. And we can't fix the problems by using the 1960s a method of doing it. Government programs. We have to give poor people money. And just get the hell out of their way. Excuse me. Because poor people are just poor. They're not stupid.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Dorfman. Maybe members could talk to Mr. Dorfman directly if they want to get his real opinion on some of these subjects. So, we've got a bunch of people waiting, so if you don't mind, we'll go ahead to the next testifiers. David Simrad? Gentlemen, thanks for your patience. Running a little behind here, but trying to get back on track.
And we'll be out of here. Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity. Members of the committee, we'll be very brief. I'm Dave Simrad, CEO for AGC of Minnesota. And with me here is Mr. Tim Werke, who's our Director of Transportation and Highway Division. Just a little introduction about AGC. We're the first national chapter of AGC of America, started in 1919. We have 400 members who are general and specialty contractors and affiliate members who do business in the construction industry. And collectively, we build the majority of the big commercial, institutional, and transportation projects here in Minnesota. Each year, Mr. Chairman, we do a study in the last quarter of the year for the upcoming year. We ask our members how they see the upcoming year in terms of the construction economy, and that information is being passed out right now in addition to our newsletter. Basically, we ask six or seven questions about the contractor's perception of the industry. And for just to highlight, we ask what their projected work volume is anticipated to be. We ask the contractors what their hiring plans are for the upcoming year. We ask also where they do their work, and we ask what their top business concern is for the year. This information is all in the report that's being passed to you, and you can read that on your own. But basically what it says is that the 2006 year looks steady in all areas. There is some negativity, and most of the negativity is in the highway sector. And I will let Mr. Murphy talk about that. He'll talk about transportation, building, and then if you have any questions, we can get to those. Tim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're many members for the record. My name is Tim Murphy, Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. It's yet to be passed around, but I have a chart here that I'm just briefly going to speak from. The focus of my comments, I think, are to implore upon you the real economic benefit that comes about by making investment in the transportation sector and the economy. I think there are studies abound that purport the number is anywhere
working.
Yes.
There's a quick question.
What's ENR? We're all trying to figure out what.
Engineering News Record.
Engineering News Record is, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Engineering News Record is really the probably the most well-known magazine in the construction industry. Engineering News Record, published by McGraw-Hill.
What's up with the chairman?
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, back to the chart that's being passed out. My purpose of my comments, again, are to implore upon you as to the impact that direct investment in public works, and in particular transportation sector of the economy, has on the ability to grow jobs, and the ability to create jobs, and to create a benefit to the national and particularly the Minnesota economy. I reference the fact that there are studies abound that indicate that the return on every $1 of investment will yield at least two and as high as I've seen up to $4 and $5 return back into the economy on transportation investments. In direct job creation nationally, a figure is widely accepted that for every $1 billion spent nationally on transportation investment, 47,500 jobs are created directly. In Minnesota, you'd equate that for every 1 million, about 47.5 jobs are created in the transportation sector directly. That is not counting the benefit that accrues to the economy through increased productivity and less congestion, safer roads, and the like. What's coming around to you is a bar chart that is information from MnDOT that is the size of the state's highway construction program for the last several years and then a couple years into the future. And I share that with you to just draw your attention to the yellow bars on that bar chart, which is the core DOT highway construction program. The red bars you see in the middle years are the resultant bonding investment from the governor's bonding package for transportation in 2003. And as we move into the years 07, 08, and beyond, you will see that that investment catches up with us in that we, beginning in fiscal year 2008, which is July of 07, we will proceed across a threshold which those of us on the advocacy side refer to as the funding cliff, meaning that the state's commitment to transportation funding is going to fall back substantially because we will be paying off the commitments that are due for those bonds that were authorized back in 2003. So I draw that your attention to that because of the critical nature of that situation. If we do nothing in terms of increasing our state's transportation funding commitment between now and the election and beyond, there will be a significant cutback in our investment in the transportation sector, which in turn will significantly reshuffle the way our transportation construction community is organized. You will not see folks that are in business today in business in 2008 if we do not do anything about this. And in fact, you may see the emergence of larger multinational firms that come in and partner with those firms that are left that are viable in order to do what work there is left in the state. So that's the extent of my comments. If there are any questions, I'll take them.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Questions? Either gentleman? Seeing none, thank you very much, and I appreciate your patience with the schedule. Bob Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and many members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. My colleagues out there are urging me to finish in 2 minutes or so because I think people are in a hurry to get going. So actually 3 points. And I will be very, very brief, Mr. Chairman. What you're being handed a copy of, and I won't crack the cover of this except to urge everybody here at a later time when you have a few minutes to sit down and read a study that was recently done and released post the end of the 2005 session by Deed on a very comprehensive analysis of insurance jobs in the state. And I just urge the committee, it's within your jurisdiction, and it's the industry that I represent, the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and it's a detailed analysis of the sectors of the insurance industry, life insurance jobs, health insurance, property casualty. And usually when you see job statistics, you'll see a clumping of those sectors. This is very helpful to show breakouts of what's happening over time in Minnesota. And what's happening is that two of the three sectors have had a decreasing number of jobs in the state, the life and the property casualty. And so I believe it's helpful to look at that and I think for us, and we'll at a later date be talking about in some more details about some of the key issues that are impacting. But just the only aggregate number, there's 55,000 employees in the insurance industry in our state that produces $7.3 billion in direct contribution to the Minnesota economy. It is an enormous industry in the state. So so that's the quick promo on that. The second item, Mr. Chairman, is really just a thank you to the committee, to you as the chair, and to the legislature for passing in the 2005 session Chapter 174, which was an Insurance Regulatory Modernization Act. We're very pleased that the legislature acted. We worked with Commissioner Wilson. We worked with you and the legislature on a very bipartisan basis and passed with virtually unanimous vote. Important updating filing procedures for auto and homeowners insurance, some optional filing procedure for life and annuity companies, some promotion of electronic commerce and modernization. We worked with the agents that collaborated with us and supported that law. And so it's just a positive step. I was at a ribbon cutting this past summer that an insurance company, a very small one, moved from Boise, Idaho to downtown St. Paul. And, you know, we look forward to continuing to see those kinds of changes and developments, because what I should have said up front is that insurance jobs, full-time insurance jobs, are very high-paying jobs. These are good jobs to get in an economy, and states around this nation compete for those jobs. So the legislature in 2005 acted on that, and I'm also here to say thank you for the legislature acting on the reduction in the life insurance gross premium tax in the 2005 session. Again, we had very broad bipartisan ownership in the House and the Senate supporting that change, and it was passed, and so that was a positive step to respond on the competitive issues for the significant number of Minnesota-based life insurance jobs to compete with states, and they just are competing. That's one of the costs that states are competing on, is reducing that. And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, just to indicate, and we'll at a later date come back and talk with many of the committee members, we actually are putting together a regulatory modernization part two for the 2006 session. And we've had meetings, and we're continuing to meet with Commissioner Wilson, with the chairs, Mr. Wilkin and Senator Scheid and others. There are some upgrades to our insurance company mutual holding company law. There are some upgrades in the filing systems for life insurance, annuities, disability insurance. There's an NAIC Model Act that's being passed around the country to, again, expedite, simplify the filing procedure. It's been passed by 20 states. Many states will pass it in this upcoming 2006 session. It's endorsed by the NCSL, NCOIL, a number of nationwide legislative organizations. So we'll be bringing that up here. And then we actually have some suggested updates and a new optional filing procedure for individual health insurance rates. It was a bill actually that was introduced by Chairman Wilkin at the tail end of the 2005 session. I think we'll probably try to roll all that together in a single bill, and fully expect it to be really not controversial. We hope to see it, you know, fully endorsed by Commissioner Wilson, and again, we'll look forward to working with many of you on a very bipartisan basis. But I'll end with this, Mr. Chairman. I'm committed and believe that insurance jobs in the state and how we manage those, we'll have other issues where we'll have plenty of opportunity to disagree on. But I think on insurance jobs, there's a lot of things that we can and need to be smart about to maintain, grow, keep, develop, because they are outstanding jobs to have in the state's economy. We've got a lot of them, and we think it's worth the effort to work with the legislature on a very bipartisan way to keep it that way. So I'll end with that, Mr. Chairman, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? Members?
Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming you're going to come around and educate us less insurance astute legislators this session. Also.
Mr. Chairman, we will come to every one of you. And as much time as you care to have us spend with you, but no, absolutely, yeah, we will do that then.
Yep. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Okay, Bob Isaacson and Steve Hine. Thank you very much for your patience. We've caught up more than I thought we would be at this point, but
thank you for the opportunity.
Do you need a laptop?
for presentation?
We handed out some
handout. Okay.
In your packages.
Members would pull out their handouts for the deed.
Okay. Given the late hour, I think shorter the length of our presentation, probably more weight for some of the information we'll give. My name is Bob Isaacson. I'm the Director of Analysis and Evaluation from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm going to be talking a little bit about, very quickly, about some business and economic trends. Then Steve Hine, who's Director of the Labor Market Information Office, is going to talk to some labor market trends. There's been a lot of discussion thus far about business competitiveness, so I'm going to try to stay focused on some of the business trends I'm seeing and what the deed has been seeing. In particular, I want to talk a little bit about solid growth prospects as we move forward. No question that there's strong growth momentum in Asia and the United States, and we expect to see that continue through 2006. And even Europe is starting to see some growth too, so that's good news for the overall economy and good news for Minnesota exporters and overall the United States as we look to sell to customers throughout the world. Within Minnesota, we've seen some positive trends for employment and overall business activity. Like the Chamber reported, we're seeing businesses indicating some expectations of increased growth in capital investment and employment in 2006. At the same time, energy costs, some rising interest rates, in fact, the trade deficit could be a spoiler opportunity depending on how they're pursued or how they move forward with different businesses. One aspect of Minnesota that has helped us is the JobZ program. This program, which began in 2004, has seen over 200 deals consummated, about 140 in 2004 and over 60 in 2005. We'll be issuing a report in early March summarizing some of the program activity, including survey results that show JobZ has been a key element in most business expansion activity in JobZ zones. We expect the activity to remain strong in 2006. The second main trend that we're seeing is global business is becoming mainstream. I think in the past we've seen some businesses dabbling in globalization, whether it be exporting, importing, or outsourcing foreign direct investment. It's becoming mainstream. Some of the work we've done seen that most exporters today in Minnesota are small businesses. You hear about the big businesses, but most exporters are small businesses. Same in the import area. Foreign direct investment and outsourcing also is something that all size businesses take part in. This is also true when we talk about industries. It cuts across all industries as well as all sizes. Some recent work we did found that over half of manufacturers and high-tech service providers are involved in globalization, directly involved in globalization. To illustrate how important trade is going to be in the coming years, in the next 10 years, trade will account for 30% of all worldwide gross domestic product, up from around 20% today. So an incredible increase in some of the activity. This is particularly important for Minnesota as we're recording record numbers of exports, up to $13 billion projected in exports for 2005. The third big trend we're seeing is energy taking a center stage. I think this is not new news for anyone in particular, but what's particularly interesting for Minnesota is the renewable energy side. Minnesota is a leader in renewable energy, and we continue to promote that within our business sector as well as with other private sector entities. In fact, we recently submitted a proposal to the federal government to help us alongside North Dakota and South Dakota to promote and improve the overall renewable energy industry, including workforce development skills. The fourth area is information, and I think we're very well aware of access to information or improving access to information. What particularly important in terms of business and workforce development is using that information, and if we don't continue to improve how we use information, we'll be flooded and drowned in the flood of information. From businesses' perspective, they continue to use information for Six Sigma and Lean operations. And job seekers' employees also must use it for career information and healthcare options, as we've heard so much about healthcare. From these perspectives, we're doing a lot to talk to clients and stakeholders to better understand how they want to see our information presented to them. We're doing a lot to ensure that we streamline information, make sure that it's used in the most relevant and high optimal use. Our fifth area is something that we call visionary employees, and by visionary I mean job seekers and incoming employees really need to use information to improve their careers and overall job seeking opportunities to determine what a future demand is going to be. Also, how to use information to help the businesses and employees they are employed by to improve their processes to improve their overall productivity. And also envision working with others that are not in the same location, virtual teams, if you will. Increasingly, teams are being formed worldwide, and we need the high-skilled jobs here to be able to work with other employees throughout the world. And bottom line for employees in visionary areas, ideas and innovation, we're building on Minnesota's tradition in that area. As businesses look to improve operations, they're really looking at a more global business model, including labor sourcing as part of their business model. Now, although outsourcing isn't being used as extensively as we thought it was being used in Minnesota, still less, about 10% of service providers do use outsourcing as a potential source of labor. However, it's interesting, a lot of businesses today are finding outsourcing a little bit more complicated and complex than they thought, and we're seeing a little bit of a decline in the exuberance and enthusiasm going over after outsourcing. In terms of where we are today in these five major trends, there's really no going back. We're really trying to take advantage of it from Minnesota's perspective. Overall, I think you've heard from a lot of testifiers today, and I think I can echo this, that Minnesota's well positioned. And the rankings, not only that were done by folks in Minnesota, but other states and other nonprofit and objective organizations, indicate that we do have a good position as we move forward, whether it be expanding our globally active businesses, we have a balanced energy portfolio, we're really looking at leveraging information, and we're looking at supplying today's businesses with tomorrow's employees. With that backdrop, let me hand it over to Steve Hine, who will take a few minutes to explain some of the labor market trends he's seen.
Okay. I think we have a question on the first part, Representative Zellers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Isaacson. In looking at the second page of your charts there, it says the job Z activity. The 200 jobs, I understand the breakdown to be about 140 in 2004, dropping down to 60 in 2005. And I'm curious if that drop has anything to do with the Hatch decision, making Minnesota and some of these job Z zones less competitive in greater Minnesota.
Mr. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We're just processing about 90 surveys that we got from businesses that actually expanded over the last 15 months, and that's part of the information we'll be collecting to better understand how the Jobsy decision was made, specifically locating the Jobsy zone, and that'll be part of it, whether the Hatch decision is going to be coming play in their role, or whether it deterred them at some level. We're also working with the subzone administrators to better understand if they're seeing a little bit of reluctance from some of the businesses they're working with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Isaacson, please, when you have either preliminary results or final results, please send them to us in the committee. We'd be very interested to see that sooner rather than later.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're looking at putting together the final report sometime in early March.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Hine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the chance to briefly talk to you about some of our recent labor market trends. And I want to say, too, I admire your stamina. I've heard a lot of mention of some of the information that we provide from our office during the earlier discussions today. So I think it's a good chance right now to bring some of this together and present an overview. I've done so with a number of charts that I believe are part of the handout. Okay, nice brightly colored things. If you turn to that first chart, that depicts the calendar year job gains or losses over the past 10 years. I think this shows that in calendar year 2005, we had the second year of solid job gains after experiencing the job losses in the recession of 2001 and the 2 years of what's been dubbed the job less or even job loss recovery. During 2005, we did regain our pre-recessionary peak that occurred in June, and as of December, we're now 22,400 jobs above that previous peak that occurred in March of 2001. We're now also 76,200 jobs above our November 2003 trough that occurred at that time. I think also, as the chart illustrates, while we've been seeing a clear expansion of jobs over the past 2 years, this growth is well short of what we consistently experienced during the late 1990s, and that's a point that I'm going to return to shortly. With regard to where these jobs have been coming from, the next chart illustrates, first of all, that industries have not performed evenly during the past year. Education and health services led the industries in which job gains were posted, as it has, in fact, every year since 1998. In 2005, we added 12,500 jobs in this sector, followed by leisure and hospitality that was up 8,000, finance and insurance, we just heard a discussion of that industry, up 6,100, and government employment up 5,500. Education and health and leisure and hospitality have been consistent job creators over the past few years, even throughout the recession. Those were two areas in which we continued to add jobs during that year of 2001. Finance and insurance and government, on the other hand, did show gains in 2005 after having slowed considerably over the last couple years. Professional and business services added 4,800 jobs during the year, and this is a sector which has continued to do well after being one of those areas that was particularly hard hit by the recession. And manufacturing, we can see, that added it added another 2,100 jobs this year, bucking what has been a national trend. On the downside, we see that trade, transportation, and utilities lost 3,900 jobs during the year. That was largely as a result of very weak seasonal hiring in retail trade this past year. Other services, it's a bit of a hodgepodge collection of different kinds of businesses, continue to lose jobs, another 1,300 this year. And construction dropped 800 as residential housing construction cooled off over the last half of last year. Relative to the nation, the next chart shows that the state continues to lag. This is a trend that began in early 2004, and for 2005, while our job growth rate was 1.2%, the nation added jobs at a 1.5% rate. Had Minnesota grown by the U.S. rate since April of 2004, we would have added about 21,000 more jobs since that time. I also want to return to that point again shortly. Despite lagging the nation overall in 2005, we did outperform the nation in 6 of the 11 major industry sectors, as the next chart illustrates. We outpaced the nation in mining, in manufacturing, in finance and insurance, in education and health services, in leisure and hospitality, and in government. Our weakness overall is primarily due to the losses that we did experience in two sectors, the trade, transportation, utilities, and construction. Along with the job growth of the past 2 years, we've also continued to see declines in unemployment, both absolute and relative to the size of the labor force. The next chart shows that the average number of people unemployed during 2005 was 25,000 lower than it was in 2003. And the unemployment rate has declined over that time period from 4.9 to 4%. To put that in context, the state's average unemployment rate over the past 30 years has been 4.8%, with the annual averages ranging from 8.1% in 82 to 2.7% in 1998. By the unemployment rate measure, Minnesota continues to outperform the nation. It's the next chart illustrates, and as it has done since we began keeping track of state-level unemployment rates in 1976. As of December, our rate was at 4.1% compared to 4.9% nationally and 4.6% a year ago, the previous December. So in terms of our utilization of our workforce, we have seen improvement, we continue to do better than the nation, and we have a rate that is not likely to decline much further without significant worker shortages arising. Yet we continue to hear about worker displacements and plant closings, events considered more likely during a recession than a period of full employment. In the next chart, I want to illustrate some trends and levels of so-called job churn. Specifically, this chart shows the monthly average number of entries into jobs and exits out of jobs by individuals across Minnesota. And one thing to take from this chart is simply the overall magnitude of this churn. Each month, about 50,000 Minnesotans leave jobs, while another 50,000 enter jobs. So over the course of a year, 600,000, about one in five of us, enter and or exit a job. Also note that this churn occurs constantly, both in good times and bad. In fact, economists consider this churn a crucial part of a robust dynamic economy. And while it's not meant to diminish the challenges of people directly involved, I think it does provide a context within which to consider the impact of such things as worker displacements and plant closings that might involve a couple of thousand individuals. Another thing that this chart illustrates is the cyclical nature of this churn. Notice that even job exits, people leaving jobs, is pro-cyclical. That is, it increases during expansions and has decreased during and since the recession of 2001. Net job declines do not stem so much from people exiting jobs more frequently as it does from fewer entries into jobs. This suggests that our recent job gains are perhaps less robust than in the past, not because layoffs are high, but rather because job creation has not rebounded to pre-recessionary levels. Another important aspect of our recent job growth is illustrated in the last chart. This shows our labor force participation rate over the past three decades. You clearly see from this chart that the trend in this rate, both statewide and nationally, has been upward for a long time. In fact, if we have the data at the statewide level, we could extend this back to the early 1960s and observe essentially a four-decade-long expansion or increase in the rate at which our working-age population is engaged in labor market activities. We can also see from this chart that Minnesota's rate far exceeds the nation. We've consistently and generally been the highest participation rate in the nation over the past few years, and lately by quite a significant amount, in fact. But what the chart also shows is a recent decline over the past 5 years. And as I noted, this is a decline that has occurred now after consistently and steadily increasing over the last 40 years. Here in Minnesota, we've seen a decline in the share of the working age population that is participating in our state's labor markets from a peak of 75.9% in March 2001, the first month of the recession, to 73.7% last month. That's a decline that translates into nearly 100,000 potential workers not participating in our labor markets that would have been had this rate simply leveled off at that March 01 level rather than declining. 100,000 individuals opting out of our labor markets. So getting back to our earlier question as to why we have lagged our job growth of the 90s and the U.S. job growth over the past couple years, in the 1990s, the job growth necessary to maintain any given unemployment rate had to be great enough to absorb both natural population growth plus the existing populace that were entering into the labor force at the time. Lately, this job growth has not had to absorb new entrants. And quite to the contrary, it can fall short of natural population growth to the extent that previously participating members of the population are exiting our labor markets, and we can still maintain a given unemployment rate. We can also see that our job growth rate may well fall short of the nation's and yet still provide for given improvement in unemployment conditions to the extent that our labor force participation rate has dropped off quite a bit more precipitously than has the nation's. Now, from one perspective, this declining participation rate is not too concerning. There's no evidence that I've been able to find that it arises from discouragement over job prospects, as is often the case at the beginning of recessions, for example. And so it does seem to be resulting from choices that people are making of their own free will and in their own best interests. On the other hand, rising participation along with rising productivity has been the key source of rising per capita incomes and standards of living. So I think we should continue to watch this trend, analyze its sources and consequences, and keep it in mind as we assess our economic performance. I think it has the potential for a significant impact if this trend continues into the future, especially in light of the upcoming retirement of the baby boom bulge in our population and a natural diminishment in our labor force participation rate that would result then. With that, I'll close. Certainly, answer any questions.
Representative Mori.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't hear any mention of wage levels, and I always wonder what that is. Just having a job is a little different from if you lose half your wages at getting it, or if you double your wages, or I mean, it's the difference there.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, you're certainly right. We do have a lot of information on wage rates, wage levels, wage changes over time. If there's more a specific focus that you have, I'd be happy to address it or discuss it later. But it is the case, just in speaking in general terms, that Minnesota has consistently been a high wage rate state, largely driven by a relatively highly skilled labor force. But even within occupations, notwithstanding a relatively high skilled labor force in relatively well-paying occupations, our wage rates have been fairly high. I think I recall that by the last measures produced of per capita incomes, we ranked 10th in the nation. And that was behind some very high cost states on the eastern seaboard and in Alaska, for example. Mm-hmm. So I could certainly address any specific questions if I can.
Representative Chairman, I'm not into your statistics enough to know how you do it, but mm-hmm. we're talking about how many people basically are going out of jobs and how many are going into them, and I'm wondering, obviously that has some effect on the overall income, but I'd like to more, and probably you don't have it today, what's created, you know, if we're creating so many jobs, are those jobs,
are they well-paying jobs?
Exactly, that's
right.
The kind of thing, or are they really well-paying, or are they are they double what people are
it's
making, or half? That makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly is a mixed bag. I think it's heartening that we are seeing the kinds of job growth rates that we have seen in areas such as finance and insurance, which is a relatively high-paying sector. Professional and business services is also one of those well-paying sectors. A lot of high-tech jobs in that area. That's why it was so hard hit during the recession. At the same time, the wage rates that are paid in areas like leisure and hospitality are relatively low paying. And, we're adding a lot of jobs in that area, which may be good, you know, for those that are interested in jobs in that area, but in terms of adding, to per capita income levels, they aren't as beneficial to us as some of those others. Construction is a relatively well-paying industry, and it's not a positive development that we're seeing declines there. I think you know what I'm getting at when I say that, well, the job declines in trade, which are relatively low-paying jobs as well, a lot of sales clerks and the like. Should serve to continue to maintain the overall level, but that aggregate level may be a bit misleading in terms of what kinds of opportunities are arising. Mm-hmm. Some are very positive in terms of pay, and some not so much.
Maybe you could work something up in the future on that.
Okay, absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Hine. I was wondering if we have any information about how our rates of the discouraged worker, the person who goes through unemployment and isn't able to find a job, compares with the national level. I've seen some national information that shows that's really growing dramatically, and you have anecdotal evidence with, I think, particularly older workers. There's a fair number who feel like they've sort of been left out of the economy. And do you have any information on how we're doing on those kind of measures?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The direct measurement of discouraged workers that you refer to at the national level aren't statistically reliable enough at the state level to be publishable, but we do look at them. In fact, the numbers have been trending downward over the last couple of years now. As job opportunities, job growth has occurred nationally, we are seeing a decline in the estimated number of discouraged workers nationally. The numbers that we do see at a state wide level, as unreliable as they may be, do at least seem to suggest a similar trend at the state level. But as a share of our labor force, that number has always been consistently very low within Minnesota. Speaks to the relative good opportunities that we have consistently had in our state. So when I talk about that labor force participation rate continuing to decline over the last 5 years, despite the upturn in our labor market conditions over the last two, that's why I say that I don't find any evidence to suggest that that's being driven by more discouragement. In fact, we're seeing very consistent trends in the other direction.
There's a question to Representative Loeffler.
And Mr. Chairman, and I guess just a general comment, we've had a fair amount of discussion and presentation on the JobZ program and its impact. And we haven't really talked, and nor have our guests today been really kind of presenting the metropolitan issue of, you know, small businesses in the urban core are in ring suburbs, who I think sometimes face the same challenges that some of our smaller rural communities do in terms of aging infrastructure, workforce, market challenges that aren't true of some of the more wealthier suburban rings. And I would hope that in the future, or if you have available in your resources, I would love to have some information about that. And maybe some of the information, if you have, about the differences in greater Minnesota regions, because I really think some of our regional centers in greater Minnesota are booming better than the exurbs. But I don't have a sense of how to put that into context with how we're helping those smaller rural communities. I think our small businesses throughout the whole state, you know, need to kind of have that insight of what's happening within our local economies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, that's right. Representative.
Yep. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it. And members, thank you for your patience. And we are adjourned.